what we call the Castle on the Hill. That's just about a half a block down from where we are now. And so everything here, what's left, is kind of like beginning to slowly deteriorate. And in fact, I call this this building where we're broadcasting from the ghost building. Right, I'm going to probably want to be the person that turns off the lights. Let me see if that's happening. No? I don't know. All right. Well, it's Easter, and I'll have to play the cynic. No offense meant to anyone who's celebrating it in the proper spirit, but so many people these days don't seem to be celebrating any religion in the proper spirit. Right? It's all about to kind of kill your neighbor, right? Here, how about this one in Glassport, Pennsylvania? Actors whipped the Easter Bunny at church show. Might not have been as gruesome as Mel Gibson's movie, but many parents and children got upset when a church trying to teach about Jesus' crucifixion performed an Easter show with actors whipping the Easter Bunny and breaking eggs. Now, people who attended Saturday's show at Glassport's Memorial Stadium quoted performers as saying, "There is no Easter Bunny." And it's kind of like blasphemous, right? You got, it ain't about the Easter Bunny. That's what they're trying to tell people. And described the show as being a demonstration of how Jesus was crucified. Melissa Saltzman, who brought her four-year-old to the event, said the program was inappropriate for young children. He was crying and asked me why the bunny was being whipped. This was all put on by the Glassport Assembly of God. The youth minister said the performance wasn't meant to be offensive. We're in the age of information, right? Isn't this the age of information where we're inundated with information? Absolutely blasted every minute of our waking hours. And so one would think that this would begin to evaporate ignorance, right? Now, how many people think that is the case? Are we getting smarter, dumber, or kind of staying the same? I'll put that out as a question if you'd like to answer. 313-298-WRIF. Now, it's almost, what would you say, most people respond, oh, everybody's getting dumber. Everybody thinks everyone else is getting dumber. Not me, not my friends, or sometimes you even think it's your friends are. But mostly, you think other people are getting dumber, and then, you know, you can have as proofs incidents like the whipping the Easter Bunny. But we're talking about how much do people know about their lives, the world around them, and all of that. Now, part of it has to do with the sources of information. I don't think it's all that, by the way, because people have in this country access to alternative sources. You don't have to believe the Pravda, Izvestia, party line corporate press. I mean, there's tens of millions of us that don't swallow the guff that comes out of the politicians' mouths in Washington. Sort of the idea. I've always thought this is a shorthand. My wife told me this years ago. If the person talking is a politician, they're wearing a suit, they're lying. I mean, that's not always true, of course. That's not always true. But you almost do better thinking that way than so many other people think the opposite way. Oh, it's a person on television, they're wearing a blue suit and a red tie, and they have a little American flag pin in their lapel, so they must be telling the truth. Or they don't even think that, it's just sort of their critical faculties fall asleep. And what is really appropriate is for all of us to always hold in abeyance what we're being told. Doesn't that make sense? You know, that bumper sticker, question authority. Let me try my little button here one more time. Let me try. Okay, now there we go. We're back. So here, there's all these polls all the time. Has anybody ever been polled? Is anybody listening? 313-298-WRIF. So the question is, people getting smarter, dumber, or are about the same? And has anyone ever been polled? I mean, that's what everyone says. I've never been polled. The percentage of Americans who believe Jews were responsible for killing Jesus has grown in recent years, although it remains a view held by a minority of people. Well, that's good. It's done by the Pew Research Center and found 26% of respondents believe Jews were to blame for the crucifixion, up from 19%. So the more information we get, and this is, I think, pre-Mel Gibson, The poll was conducted now amid controversy over Mel Gibson's epic, The Passion of the Christ. Some say the film unfairly portrays the role of Jews in Jesus' death, while Gibson and others insisted the movie is not anti-Semitic and faithful to the gospel accounts. All right. Also, we're kind of going at religion now. I want to talk about the September 11th hearings. Condoleezza Rice's little performance there, the presidential memo. The presidential memo said, Al-Qaeda is in the country and means harm to us. But they didn't take that seriously because it wasn't very specific. It would have been like FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1941, would have gotten a memo that say, Japanese fleet in the Pacific intends strike at U.S. assets, and he would have said, well, it's not very specific. I'm going to go down to, well, he didn't go down to his ranch. He went up to his place. What was the name of it? In Maine, or was it even in Canada? Portobello? No, I'm just hungry. Something like that. Campobello. So is that in Maine, or is that in Nova Scotia or New Brunswick? 313-298-WRIF. You can answer little questions like that if you want, or big ones if you're far away. Hello to many of you listening around the country and around the world. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. You can listen through, well, you must be doing something if you're listening online, radiopower.org. And I have been remiss recently in not mentioning whiterose.org as well. Whiterose.org. And that has the archives of this show. You can always go hear it there. Radiopower.org repeats this program twice on Mondays. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The website, peterwerbe.com. PeterWerbe.com. Someone wrote, and you can email me through there as well. Someone wrote in just tonight and said, you looser. You know, L-O-O-S-E-R. They didn't like what I was saying on my website, so they said I was a looser. Huh. Wonder what that means. Anyways, let's welcome Jay Hudson. Jay Hudson is now our producer and phone screener. When you call 313-298-WRIF, you will reach him first. Again, all of my gratitude to Rick Fox, who served in that position for a couple of years. Now, here's another poll. Most Americans, this is actually interesting, most Americans oppose gay marriage, and many believe homosexuality is, quote, against God's will, but otherwise consider themselves tolerant of gays. Now, how could you, I mean, that doesn't make a bit of sense. I mean, I'll get to the end of this, in fact. 60% of those polled, well, here, maybe I should do it in order. 55 to 41% of those polled agreed with the statement that, quote, if gays are allowed to marry, the institution of marriage will be degraded. And it's only 14% separating people. If gays are allowed to marry, the institution of marriage will be degraded. I don't get it. I'm married, and I know gays that have gotten married in San Francisco, and a couple that I know in Massachusetts that are planning to get married. I don't know. I mean, I don't feel like my marriage is being degraded or the institution. Tell me how. I just don't get that at all. Increasingly, people are realizing it's absolute stupidity to have a constitutional amendment that discriminates against people, including the daughter of the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney. Now, 60% of us think that homosexuality is against God's will? Ooh, that's scary. That's very scary. A similar percentage felt that legal recognition of same-sex marriages were inevitable. So 60% think that it's against God's will. It's this abominable sin against nature. And yet 60% of us think it's going to happen anyway. But then it gets very cool. And this is hopefully the way we should be in this. And look out for people that don't share this. 60% of those polled describe themselves as sympathetic to the gay community. I mean, maybe you could say, you know, people used to say back in the 60s, some of my best friends are Negroes, you know, because show that they weren't racist. So maybe they're just saying this. But it's cool if it has become unfashionable to be homophobic. We should just tell all the morning shows that, right? About the same percentage, 60% said they'd be willing to vote for an openly gay candidate. Why not? Who cares who people are boinking? I don't. And so at the end of this little reportage on religion, given this is Easter, isn't it Passover as well? President Bush said Easter Sunday he was praying for American casualties to ebb, to be reduced in Iraq. But he braced the public for more in a U.S.-led fight that he described as right for the security of our country. Boy, I don't understand that at all. But you get to a pretty desperate level when you start praying, when you start praying for the reduction of casualties. Now, aren't the people on the other side praying for the increase of casualties? I mean, this is the religious madness. And, you know, we're so disparaging of those Muslim extremists, the other with a big capital O. You know, they're so maniacal about their religion. But what is this? The President of the United States is praying for casualties to lessen. Never occurred to him that maybe that they're as high as they are because of his absolute failed policies? I want to talk about that a little later. And you can see how bad it is here in Detroit when Detroit police officers are praying for a reduction in violence. Well, that's your, I mean, that's an admission of desperation, as far as I can see. You don't get much more desperate when you think there is nothing I can do to affect reality. When I'm trying to administer a particular situation, I've got to pray. I can't carry out policies that will actually bring about what I would like to happen or what I think should happen to make a safe and peaceful community like here in Detroit or a safe and peaceful world, so I'll pray. And on the other hand, the people on the other side are praying for the exact opposite. Whew. Well, tell me what you think. 313-298-WRIF. We don't have a modern system here, so I have no idea what you're going to talk about. If you'd like to bring up this catastrophe in Iraq that Bush has led us into. What is it now? 660 Americans dead. 600 dead Iraqis in Fallujah alone. A Marine commander there said they're almost all military fighters. Reporters, Western reporters, U.S. reporters, talk about hundreds of women and children that have been killed. And and that's how many are killed. You imagine how many are injured. Usually three times that. So it's come to that. All right. I'll be off on that too long. I'll bring that up in a little while. You bring up what you would like. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werbe. I'm the host of Night Call. And hi, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter. It's Chris from Royal Oak.
Hi, Chris.
I've been a long-time listener, long-time fan. I've told you that a couple times. I met you once in person and shared that with you just to give you a little pat on the back for the work that you do for so many people that would otherwise not hear a truthful discussion on any of these matters.
No, thank you, Chris. What's on your mind?
A couple of things. The first one is the brouhaha about the Passion of Christ, and is it blaming the Jews for Christ's death? I think regardless of your stand on it, I think this is something to chew on for especially the more Christian fundamentalist type people. They always tell us that Christ died for our sins, and that's why we are saved, and that's why we have an opportunity to go to the great afterlife. Well, were it not for those people that killed him, he wouldn't have made that sacrifice.
Right. It's part of the script. I mean, the Nicholas Kazantzakis book, The Last Temptation of Christ, when Jesus says he doesn't want to be the Christ, he wants to just get married and live a normal life, and also Judas doesn't want to turn him in, and finally, I don't know if this exactly was, I read it so many years ago, but they say, hey, well, there's a larger script that has to be worked out, so all of this had to happen given the, what would you call it? I'll just call it the script and let people can...
Yeah, well, the point that I was getting at is if somebody's like, you know, for all those who are worried that this is going to be anti-Semitic, saying the Jews killed Christ. But if you look at it, the fundamentalist ought to praise the Jews,
sure,
and say, look, because of what you did, now we're all saved. And, you know, as mad as that string of logic is to begin with, the second thing I wanted to bring up...
Well, just before you do, Chris, let me just say that rather than sort of thanking them for the favor, that the Passion, the Easter time, has historically been a point, fortunately doesn't happen very much anymore, but particularly during the Middle Ages and way into the 20th century, that that this was a period in which Jews in Europe particularly were dreaded, because this is when attacks from the Christian community would come, that this rage that this was done to the Son of God. But like you said, I mean, this is part of the redemption story. But what's your second point?
My second point is, you were asking about, with the proliferation of information available to us all, are people getting dumber, are people getting smarter, more aware, less aware, what have you? From my observation, and they're anecdotal at best, but my observations tell me that as more information becomes available, some of us look at more information to verify what we hear, to seek out other opinions from a foreign press or whatnot, whereas the other half, I think Lincoln called them those that can be fooled all the time,
right?
Those folks have to make simply a more conscious effort to stay away from any sources of information
that contradict
other than the ones that they have already agreed to seek, you know, to view as the definitive authority.
Yeah, well, that's pretty clear, and that's what I said. I've said so many times, the function of these right-wing talk shows and their popularity is they're in a polemic, an argument with reality. And so when they see what's happening in Iraq and this catastrophe of tremendous proportions that Bush has led us into through lies and misjudgments, that they go, well, what can I say now? And then you turn into any one of these right-wing freaks, and they've got the answers for you. Hey, it's not so bad. It's only a minority. It's thugs and what have you. Hey, Chris, thanks for joining me from Royal Oak. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. I've listened to you for a long time. This is John from Taylor.
Hi, John. Welcome.
Wanted to make a comment about what you said about the ignorance of people today. I honestly find that more people, regardless, are either becoming more ignorant or more intolerant towards other people's view.
Well, there is certainly the intolerance. I mean, you know, two wrongs don't make a right, not the other way around. Two wrongs don't make a right. But I think the intolerance has come from the right wing, and that has created, I think, the context in people that always were, that prided themselves on tolerance now, has none for the conservative right.
Well, I think something that my father's once said to me is, I've made mention to a couple of essays I've written for school, has been that the Christians or the Catholic Church only gives out compassion to those who fit their moral code.
Well, that's true, unfortunately, with so many. I mean, there is not a universal sense that when someone bleeds, it doesn't matter what their nationality or race or religion. When someone is discriminated against, the same thing. When someone is hurt or, you know, emotionally scarred. But very frequently we can draw these lines based on race or religion or nationality or something like that. So we're like tremendously upset when we see what's happened to four Americans in Fallujah. And if you tell Americans, well, 600 people were killed in Fallujah by the United States, there's not much of a reaction.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the way our society has become. Another thing that I've always kept in mind has been the person can be smart, but society is stupid.
All right, John. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thanks for calling in. If you're ringing, I think, Jay's got a handle on it all, because he also produces the show right before this, Motor City Riffs. But if you're ringing, keep on ringing, and Jay will get to you. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter. This is Andy from Dexter. Great show.
Hi, Andy.
Hi, just going to comment on the dumbing of America. I think America is completely getting dumb, and it has to do with the media and TV. These reality shows leaves you nothing to think about. I spent time in Europe, and European people know more about American politics than us.
I think that's true.
I'd just like to comment on that. And the radio, I think it nowadays is completely terrible. A lot of these stations play bands that were put together and no more real rock and roll. I think they need to play more real rock and roll. Little Steven's got a good show, and radio should keep going in that direction. That's all I got to say.
All right. Thank you very much, Andy from Dexter. Used to do some bike riding. I started doing that. I don't know why I've stopped riding. I used to ride from Ann Arbor to Dexter. Sometimes go through Dexter and then go to Hell, Michigan. Ever been there? Isn't that where they have the bar, the dam site inn by a dam? And so we would ride to Hell. That was our ride, Hell and back. We would ride from Ann Arbor to through Dexter to Hell and then back to Ann Arbor and have a good Italian dinner. A lot of carbs. Screw that no carb stuff. I live on carbs. I have an all-carb diet. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Happy Easter. This is Terry from Dearborn.
Hi, Terry.
I need to talk about kind of Lisa Rice and 9/11 Commission, but I first want to comment quickly on the show. You seem to be progressing. It's an excellent show. I've always loved it. Got a new producer. You always have an intelligent show, a refreshing perspective. You even have a West Coast correspondence crew. There's even more than one in Santa Cruz reporting for you.
Okay.
Quickly weigh in on the intelligence issue there. I think the people who are smart are getting smarter because there is more information, where the people who are not that smart are probably getting dumber because there's too much of the nonsense and propaganda in their ears. Like, there's an old elementary school saying that says a mind is like a parachute. It only functions when it's open.
Right.
So that's how I explain that. Anyway, to the Condoleezza Rice, I came up with a new term just for her testimony, the way she performed.
Sure.
It's called weasel ease. We've all heard of legal ease, you know, legal terms.
Yeah, I love it.
And the way she speaks, the weasel speak, it's weasel ease, the constantly denying or trying to deny all the basic facts, and then the totally passing the buck all over the country. Oh, that was the FAA, the FBI was doing that, CIA was doing that. How do you expect me to do that? I mean, it's just a disgrace to the country, a disgrace to the whole office of the presidency. I mean, this is
sure.
So much
well,
worse.
That's what happens when you have a presidency that was, I mean, even forgetting about the Supreme Court decision, which I don't, but the majority of people in this country did not want George W. Bush and this band of far-right wingers to run this country. And because one thing, they have a bad history. They run everything into the ground that they ever touch. They have the Midas touch in reverse. And you know because of September 11th, they were able to, I think, bamboozle a lot of us. They were able to certainly and easily bamboozle the press. But now it's all starting to unravel. That they sat on their hands when all the signs of an imminent attack were there. I mean, think about this. What did they have to do in order to protect this country? For one thing, they could have had the Air Force on alert. There is great, great debate about the role of the Air Force and why it didn't scramble quicker and why it took longer than is permissible under the rules that govern that kind of thing. That they knew those after a while that those planes had been hijacked. That they could have had sky marshals on as many planes as they could, particularly leaving from big cities. They could have increased security at the airport. Certainly in place. They couldn't have had a big elaborate system like now, but maybe they wouldn't have let that many guys on a plane with weapons, with one-way tickets, and all the rest of it. So, the other thing, the final thing, Richard Clark apologized to the families of the survivors of September 11th. We failed. Now, it doesn't mean, sometimes you can try your damnedest and still fail, but at no point did anybody from the Bush administration, other than Richard Clark, Bush's security advisor, terrorist advisor, say that we apologize, we are sorry that that this occurred? That they could have said it like that. We have this great sense of failure, even though they could make the argument they tried their hardest, but whatever, they missed the cues. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Ben Birch, who is the webmaster of WhiteRoseSociety.org, I said the website wrong, and this is unforgivable. He says, a small mistake. Well, Ben, you're being very nice. It's not a small mistake at all. It wouldn't get you there. In fact, I think you get something totally weird if you don't put the whole thing in there. Anyways, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and you can get archives of other talk show hosts who have politics to the left of Mussolini. Man, there are some of us. You know, we're not all, proto-fascists that broadcast talk shows. So you might want to check that out. WhiteRoseSociety.org. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe.com, and go up to the top bar. It says On the Air. You go there and you hook on to Ben Burch's wonderful site. And also there is my audition CD. Ben still hopes, like some other people do, that I can again get a national show. I think I've had my 15 minutes of national fame, Ben. I've been here in Detroit forever, and this is just fine. But thank you for your effort. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening. Hi.
Hi, Peter Werbe.
Yeah, it's me.
Hi, how you doing? Hi, it's Ron from Stevenson, Ontario.
Well, welcome. Thanks for making the program international. Where's Stevenson, Ontario?
About 5 minutes from Lake Erie, right across from Ohio. I love your show, and I really miss the hijinks from the morning crew there. I'm going to have to get into sports a bit more, I think. But, I just wanted to touch on your topic about are we getting smarter?
Yeah.
Well, my view is that we're really in a society that's either liberal or Tory. Like, this is coming from a Canadian aspect, right? And what I find is that we shouldn't have these party lines like this, because we should actually have somebody that's in place that is qualified, and for any job that you'd go for, you'd have to have your qualifications, right? Rather than going along these party lines.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel that, like, being Canadian and up here and seeing what's going on in the world but basically how our government is run, it's really a sham. It's quite disgraceful, if you ask me.
What do you mean, the Canadian government?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Like, I mean, because you've got your Liberal or your Tory, right?
Right.
And really, if you want to look at the mafia, well, just look at John Chrétien's government, what he's done with this different boondoggle, and geez, he's quite a garge.
Well, governments have a bad history in general. I don't know that I completely agree with you. Trying to vote for the individual, and then you spend all this time trying to wonder whether John Kerry uses Botox on his lips, or do we trust him as an individual? I mean, which is just absolute nonsense. Having a party, I mean, that seems to make a lot more sense. You have a party that stands for something. And it's almost sort of incidental who the individual is.
Yeah.
People represent, the values of that particular party, although they can be just, the parties obviously are just as corrupt as individuals can be.
Well, as far as things go, if we're getting smarter, then the environment and things like that are going to, like right now, we think we've got a handle on things such as Iraq or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole scheme of things in my mind is that we've got this globalization. So what you've got is holy wars and everything else. Like, I mean, everything from the bugs. We got Asian, we got ash borer down here. We just had to cut out 80,000 trees.
That's
came from
terrible.
Michigan, from a crate. And what's the next thing?
Well, I don't know. I when you say what's the next thing, I was just talking with friends of mine. That's what we're all doing, waiting for the next shoe to fall. All right, Ron, again, thanks for joining us. Thanks for making the show international. 313-298-WRIF. Yvette writes into Call Talk Yes at yahoo.com. Technically, Jesus died because of humanity's sins. Technically, didn't Jesus die because of humanity's sins? So it wasn't the Jews specifically that killed Jesus, but it's humanity and the very people who are blaming the Jews who are responsible for his death through their sins. Through their sins. Kind of funny, isn't it? The logic kind of eludes me on the sins of the generations part, unless there was some kind of time machine, but that's another whole subject. Please don't go off the air, she asked. Well, okay, I won't. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
What's up, Peter? How are you doing?
Good.
Good, Taylor. Hey, I just want to say that people that already are aware of all the lies and everything from the administration, the current one, the past one, and possibly, hopefully not, but the way things have gone, probably the future ones, everybody that knows that this is baloney, that's not doing anything, including myself, I want everyone to get more active. We need more organizing. We got to be more active, and let our voices be more heard.
Well, that is the key. That is the key to it all. You got it.
Right? And people that are on the fence that aren't fully aware, aren't sure which side they're on, and they need to go to places like your website and seek alternative media outlets and places to hear about what's really going on. We need to get out there and do something.
Yeah, I agree. Do something is the key. The people that rule us, they depend on our passivity. They depend on us doing nothing. All right, thanks a lot. I've got to take our first break here. But if you come back, I want to talk about, can we put ourselves in the place of another? I know people say that a lot. But let's take that up in terms of Iraq and what's happening there now. Right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
Has your day sounded something like this? Perhaps you need to change your tune. May I suggest a Captain Morgan's Parrot Bay Breeze, made in sweet harmony with pineapple and cranberry.
Yeah, drinks are on the house!
Ah, music to the senses. Captain Morgan's Parrot Bay Coconut Flavored Rum. The rum capital of the world is closer than you think. It's in your glass whenever you pour a Puerto Rican rum. Only the finest rums come from Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rican rum with natural coconut flavor. 21 to 24% alcohol by volume. Captain Morgan Rum Company. Drink responsibly. Captain's orders.
Spark your night with a tropical taste of Captain Morgan's Parrot Bay Coconut Flavored Rum. Enjoy a bay breeze made with pineapple and cranberry. Parrot Bay and cola or a Parrot Bay and cranberry. Mix them all with good friends and good times.
Why are men all over America talking about testosterone? Listen.
I am 59 years old. I've been taking the testosterone product, and I feel better than I did 25 years ago.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. In many men, testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35, but now there's testosterone, the complete performance-boosting system I designed for men who are starting to feel their age. If you don't feel like the man you used to be, call now for a 30-day risk-free trial of the testosterone system, which includes my bonus report on aging and its effects on energy and sex drive, free with your order.
Call now for your confidential trial of testosterone. 1-888-207-9725. 1-888-207-9725. Guaranteed to work for you or your money back. 1-888-207-9725. 1-888-207-9725. Results will vary.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine Online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like Tycoons and BT's Avenue B, a five-star menu with Detroit's finest female entertainment. entertainment. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Dr. Roche, put your best face and body forward with help from Dr. Roche.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Experience a night of madness.
Here comes the pain!
The Jägermeister Music Tour. Yeah! Featuring Reaver of Slipknot. Special guests, Fear Factory and Chimera. Sold out, so you gotta win tickets. The Jägermeister Music Tour. Be there for a chance to get a promotional Jäger Music compilation CD and a chance to win custom tour prizes from Schecter, Peavey, Pearl, Meinl, and Coffin Case, where permitted by law. This show is sold out, so the only way you're going is to keep listening for your chance to win tickets. It's the Jägermeister Music Tour.
With Slipknot, Fear Factory, Chimera,
and more.
For more info, check out JägermeisterMusicTour.com or Slipknot1.com.
You gotta be 21 and over to receive prizes. Brought to you by Jägermeister Liqueur.
35% alcohol by volume, imported by Sydney Frank and Porting Company. New Rochelle, New York. Drink responsibly.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. One of the questions we are addressing tonight is, in the age of information, are we getting smarter? Are we dumber? Or is it just the same, just sort of a wash? Mark is listening in the Bronx, New York, and on the Internet, obviously. He said, is it possible the majority of Americans have become either too lazy or preoccupied with their personal lives that it's become easy to condition them to whatever mainstream media feeds them? What are your thoughts? Have we become so caught up in this that we've forgotten how to think? Well, if... Yes and no. I mean, I think that people are extraordinarily discouraged about being able to affect the world in which they live. I mean, this is, I think, one reason you're seeing this upsurge in interest in religion. I mean, whenever nations are at a crisis period, they often find themselves turning to religious answers instead of concentrating on the practical social answers. So you have the man responsible for this catastrophic decision to invade Iraq praying that we that more American soldiers don't get killed. Well, I don't think that they've got much of a chance on that. I mean, that there's not going to have, prayers are not going to affect that. I don't think it's going to affect that at all. Well, let's go to just a little bit. I'll get back to the calls. Bush. And this, remember, right before the break, if you were listening, I said probably the hardest thing is to put ourselves in the place of another person. I know you've heard this before. But it really is hard when you're having an argument with a parent or a spouse or a friend or anybody like that to actually think about how they're viewing you. Or if you're an employer or an employee, to think about how your boss or how your employee is thinking. Put yourself actually in their position. And so what happens to people that are officially designated as enemy, as the other, with a big capital O, they don't have human characteristics like us. I was saying a little of that earlier. They don't bleed. They don't experience misery. They don't have fear. They don't have hopes or dreams or families or anything like that. They're the enemy with a big capital E. And to some extent, that's necessary, that kind of in-group propaganda to, particularly if you're under attack. Because always in wars, there would be some disparaging name. And particularly the United States for the last 50 or 60 years has fought people of color all around the world for good reasons and bad. Increasingly for bad, of course. Now here, this is Bush in his weekly radio address. This week in Iraq, our coalition forces have faced challenges and taken the fight to the enemy. The coalition forces have taken the fight to the enemy. On one hand, they've carried out this massacre in Fallujah, essentially this collective punishment, this punitive expedition for these four American mercenaries who were killed in their bodies. I can't think of the word I'm thinking of. Well, treated horribly, but there's another word for that. Now, there was this absolutely telling article alongside of the same one in the New York Times today. Suddenly, the people that, well, you know, changes. It's the rationale du jour. You know, what's the rationale for being in Iraq? Well, first it was weapons of mass destruction that turned out to be a monstrous and purposeful lie. Then it was, came down when we were going to liberate and free the Iraqi people. And now somehow we're trying to create a model of democracy in the Middle East. Of course, you have this guy, Paul Bremer, who is the dictator of Iraq. He appoints the government. He closes newspapers. This is one of the things that started it. And he talks about these people that are rebelling against a legitimate authority. Now, how did Paul Bremer wind up to be the dictator of Iraq? I mean, where did the United States get the legitimacy to invade in the first place? The United States, under George W. Bush, broke international law. The only time you can invade a country if there's an imminent threat to your nation. Well, there was no threat from Iraq whatsoever. Zero. Not a single thing. And you hear him referring to Sheikh al-Sadr as a two-bit thug. Now, I mean, I wonder how they perceive us. This is what I'm saying. Here we are, this Christian nation, as the Bushies are going to tell us, once again occupying Muslim land. I mean, it's so reminiscent of the Crusades to them. And so imagine how they perceive us. We are the liberators. Well, they knew we had a beef. Well, first off, they knew. Most Iraqis know a lot of their history. The United States, people in the United States don't know very little. History began like a couple of weeks ago. And so, weapons of mass destruction, that's like talking about Monica Lewinsky. Why are you still talking about that? Next you're going to talk about the 2000 election or some other thing that doesn't matter. But Iraqis know their history. And they know that Saddam Hussein was supported by the United States. They know the Ba'athist Party, with all of its murders and what have you, got all sorts of support during the 70s and the 1980s from the United States. And they understand that that Iraq was manipulated into fighting Iran, and that the Saddam government was assisted by the United States. So they're not real pleased with the United States in general. If they take out Saddam Hussein, who probably was hated by the majority of people. But, you know, dictators are often loved. Stalin was loved. Hitler was loved. You've got to remember that. But calling someone who's heading an uprising in their own country against a Western occupier that talks about it being motivated by Christianity, come on. How the hell do you think we're going to be perceived? And this al-Sadr, this young cleric who is leading this rebellion that is apparently still occupying cities in southern Iraq. Have you noticed that since the United States is trying to capture or kill him, that he is hiding from the forces of the United States? So, but Bremer said he's holed up. See, this is to completely undercut any legitimacy he might have. Now, where does Bremer get his legitimate authority from? Where did he get the right to rule Iraq? Where does Bremer get the right to close newspapers or to abolish labor unions like he's done? Now, let me just quickly get at this because I want to get back to my calls. This was right alongside of it. Remember also, they keep saying, oh, it's just a few people. They're always diminishing everything. You know, it's only 600 people have been killed in Fallujah. This is a massacre. And, it was all fighters. Well, Western reporters have seen the graves of children and women, mostly children and women. Munir Munther is ready to kill Americans, it says here. For months, he has been struggling to control an explosion of miserable feelings, humiliation, fear, anger, and depression. Munther, a 35-year-old laborer, said, but in the last 2 weeks, these feelings blow up inside me. The Americans are attacking Shiite and Sunni at the same time. They've crossed the line. I had to get a gun. He and a team of helpers have been especially busy at night. We start work after 11 p.m. Our group is small, just friends. We don't even have a name. And they go out and they set bombs. A new surge of Iraqi resistance is sweeping up thousands of people, Shiite and Sunni, in a loose coalition united by overwhelming anti-Americanism. So it doesn't seem like they want to be liberated by us, does it? How many Americans have died this week? I mean, you know, conservative, they don't care about Iraqis. The hell with them. They just want to win. You listen to the conservative shows and, it's, you know, all these right-wing talk show hosts that scammed out of the Vietnam War, chicken hawks, they're called, that rooted on working-class men in the 1960s while they scammed out of the draft. Now they're in their 50s and 60s, and they are rooting on a new generation of working-class men and now women to kill and be killed. Now, here's what it says. In Baghdad, Kufa, Najaf, Bakuba, and Fallujah, interviews with Sunnis and Shiites alike show a new core of men and a few women who have resolved to join the resistance. They also reveal a generation of young people inured to violence and hankering to join in the fighting. These are Iraqis revolting against American occupation, and this is now who George W. Bush designates as the enemy. Well, we certainly have become the enemy, haven't we? There's a little bit more here, and I think it's worth reading. Ala Mohammed is a 24-year-old mechanic in Baghdad. The other day, when the trouble broke out in the predominantly Shiite neighborhood he lives in, he dashed home from work, grabbed a clip for his Kalashnikov, and took it out in front. If the Americans come this way, we will fight them, Mr. Mohammed said. I'm going to defend my house, my street, my land, my religion. He stood on the sidewalk in sweatpants without shoes. He said, I like to fight barefoot. Our troops are in Kevlar armor, have tanks and Cobra gunships and helicopters. He's fighting barefoot against our neighbors, our sons and daughters, our relatives. Finally, it says, a whole generation of Iraqi youth is coming of age in the bitter heart of the resistance. When the four American security consultants were ambushed and killed in Fallujah, it was a mob of boys that set the bodies on fire and dragged two to a bridge where they hung them over the Euphrates River. Desecrated the body, of course, is the word I was looking for. Saran Karim, a 16-year-old with thick, man-sized hands, said killing Americans was not just a good thing. It's the best thing, said Saran outside of Fallujah school. They are infidels. They are aggressive. They are hunting our people. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm going to the rest of this. Like the angry youth of the West Bank and Gaza, Iraqi children are increasingly surrounded by music, images, leaflets, and praise for fighters. Sings Sabah al-Janabi, a popular Iraqi performer, in a song that made the rounds even before the killing of the contractors. They won't call them mercenaries, contractors. The men of Fallujah are men for hard tasks. They paralyzed America with rocket-propelled grenades. The men of Islam will fight the Americans like leaderless soldiers will drag Bush's corpse through the dirt. This is what they're singing about us in Iraq. And what do these conservatives want to do? They want to kill more Iraqis. These are the enemy. Instead of getting the hell out of there. I mean, how much more of an invitation do you need that these people don't want to be liberated on our terms? Abdul Razak al-Muyami. Let me see. I don't think I'm saying that right. Anyway, a 32-year-old laborer said, I trained my son to kill Americans. That is one reason I am grateful to Saddam Hussein. All Iraqis know how to use weapons. Like so many parents, he said American soldiers had humiliated him in front of his children. They search my house, they kick my Quran, they speak to me so poorly in front of my children. It's not that I encourage my son to hate Americans, it's not that I make him want to join the resistance. Americans do that for me. He said his 10-year-old son did not take part in the violence against the contractors, but because of all the miseries he knew Americans had brought, he would have. He said, Dad, it was exactly like what they did to us. Now, again, the ability to put ourselves in the place of others. When Americans, when we looked at the desecration of those bodies, burned, killed, burned, and hung from that bridge over the Euphrates, that we thought, what kind of people are these? What kind of human beings would do that to a dead human, rather than respecting the dead, desecrating it in that manner? Here's what this 10-year-old said. Dad, it was exactly like what they did to us. They burned our women. They burned our children. They burned our men. My son said, this time we killed and burned four of their dead, but hopefully one day we will kill and burn them all. He said, just imagine, he's only 10 years old and he says that. Just imagine that. Time to get out of Iraq. Bring the troops home now. What do you say? Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, good evening. My name is Jay. I'm from New Baltimore.
Hi, Jay.
Commenting on a few things. First of all, was this quick comment, maybe a little lighter, about the intelligence of people lately.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that people become more cynical with more information that's put out there. That's just something that I'm finding more. I don't know if it's so easy to comment on whether or not they're becoming more or less intelligent. But there's definitely a large amount of cynicism kind of creating in it. If you talk about deaths and catastrophe and how the media does portray and glamorize a lot of the horrible things that are happening in our world today. I don't know if you find that true at all or notice that in your own circles, but I know it's a lot more cynicism and less regard for catastrophe and events like perhaps in the past.
I think that's an interesting observation, yeah.
I guess a lot. Well, the other thing is Iraq. Being a soldier myself, I was 7 years, and I went to Bosnia, and seeing everything happens that goes along with war, occupation, humanitarian missions, whatever you want to call them, propaganda and stuff. So many points you brought up as I was listening here, but one of the interesting things that continually comes up is about how the Iraqi people are rebelling and how Americans are reacting to the views of those four bodies of those mercenaries that were murdered and desecrated, as you said. The Iraqis, their own infrastructure, also use propaganda and such to, you know, further their own means, whether it's the Shiites or the Sunnis or whatnot. I think that the frustration that the people feel for not understanding, if the Americans over there, sent by President Bush and whatever mission we have over there, either it's liberation, whether it's occupation or what, it's already underway. We have soldiers who are, what, 19 to 24 for the most part?
Sure.
What type of, are they, they're not politicians, they're mainly people either looking for a better life or college money. They're not trained as public affairs relations officers. They're definitely not trained as humanitarians. They're given a very basic understanding of combat and unity and patriotism and, yes, the good old dose of propaganda to get you less afraid to go out there and risk your life walking through the streets of a foreign country. When you do and you have this constant, like we're granted so much immunity from the stress of being in a dangerous situation on a daily basis, which these soldiers are not. And I'm not saying it's a perfect solution, but rationale why it happens. But day after day, the stress of these missions and these deaths, and these Americans don't understand necessarily why they're being shot at and who's actually shooting at them. They gather up as much intelligence as they can, and they react.
Well, I can imagine after a while, it doesn't matter what the reason is. You have loyalty to the men in your unit. You see people that hate you and that they're shooting at you, and you react in kind.
Exactly. And you have to kind of dehumanize people to kill them. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, you can't kill nice people who are your friends. You have to kill awful people who are your enemies.
Exactly. And it's, and the terrible part about that is all sides use this propaganda machine for various things. I'm definitely not supporting what happened in Iraq. I would say now, though, even if Kerry does become elected or Bush continues, the problem has already been created.
Oh, absolutely. And remember that Bush the Elder left Clinton with Somalia. Sort of a little poison pill to begin his presidency. Jay, I got to take a break right now, so thanks for having joined us. I appreciate your observations. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
From Miramax Films, on her wedding day, her friends betrayed her and left her for dead.
Bad idea.
But this Friday, the bride is back. And has taken a solemn vow.
I am gonna kill Bill.
Ebert and Roper give Kill Bill Volume 2 two thumbs way up.
Well, I'm flattered.
It's even better than Volume 1.
Pretty cool.
Thrilling, exciting, and twisted. Rolling Stone raves. Tarantino keeps the action coming like gangbusters. He knocks it out of the park.
She cut her way through 88 bodyguards.
No, they just call themselves the Crazy 88.
How come?
I don't know. I guess they thought it sounded cool.
Uma Thurman in the new film by Quentin Tarantino. Kill Bill Volume 2. Rated R for violence, language, and brief drug use. In theaters everywhere this Friday. Kill Bill Volume 2 original soundtrack in stores April 13th.
Men, how do you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control, and see how much longer you last with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
Spike TV presents Game Riot, powered by Xbox. This Monday, April 12th, 4 p.m. at Clutch Cargo's, the largest traveling video games festival in the world. All you can eat video games, zoo, and unreleased titles on state-of-the-art plasmas and Alienware systems. Check out 30 new and unreleased video games, including Ninja Gaiden, Unreal Tournament 2004, Battlefield Vietnam, and more. Enter Xbox competitions on stage featuring Rally Sport Challenge 2, Soul Calibur 2, America's Army, and 16-player Halo Deathmatch. Win new games, take home giveaways, and groove to Spike DJ Crossfader and the Scratch DJ Academy. You can't get this on your couch. Check it out this Monday at Clutch Cargo's. Tickets at cc.com, ticketmaster.com, Ticketmaster, or charge at 248-645-6666. Or come into EB Games for a limited special offer. Spike TV, Game Riot. For more, check out GameRiot.com.
From Miramax Films. On her wedding day, her friends betrayed her and left her for dead.
Bad idea.
But this Friday, the bride is back. And has taken a solemn vow.
I am gonna kill Bill.
Ebert and Roper give Kill Bill Volume 2 two thumbs way up.
Well, I'm flattered.
It's even better than Volume 1.
Pretty cool.
Thrilling, exciting, and twisted. Rolling Stone raves. Tarantino keeps the action coming like gangbusters. He knocks it out of the park.
She cut her way through 88 bodyguards.
No, they just call themselves the Crazy 88.
How come?
I don't know. I guess they thought it sounded cool.
Uma Thurman in the new film by Quentin Tarantino. Kill Bill Volume 2. Rated R for violence, language, and brief drug use. In theaters everywhere this Friday. Kill Bill Volume 2 original soundtrack in stores April 13th.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try.
All right, thank you very much. Oh, cut him right off. Sorry, Mr. Announcer. He's glaring at me from his booth. All right, we're back with our second hour of WRF's Night Call. WRF Detroit is where we're located. You may be listening anywhere in the world on the Internet, or if you're here in the Detroit area, or if you're anywhere around the country, you want to call 313-298-WRIF. If you want to email in, call talk yes. Call talk yes at yahoo.com. We started talking about, because there was this report that an increasing number of people think the Jews killed Jesus. I won't even go in back into that. So, you know, as we get more information, it seems like people are getting dumber. Also, the appearance on, what was it, Wednesday, of Condoleezza Rice talking about 911 and saying, oh, you know, they had no idea it was all historical stuff. Then this memo comes out and it says Al-Qaeda in the country planning imminent attacks. And Bush says, I didn't get any direct information. You know, if I would have known they were going to fly a plane into the building, I would have done something. Well, I believe that. But isn't there a lot more that he could have done? Didn't this administration fall flat on its face? Didn't the administration that so many people thought was the one to guard us against terrorism drop the ball like they've dropped the ball on everything imaginable? From terrorism to war, to the environment, to people's rights, the middle class, labor rights, women's rights. This is the most disastrous administration in American history. Bush should get out of Iraq and resign. Say, look, I mean, here's what a real human being would do. Look, I know the majority of American people voted against me. I came in like gangbusters, and rather trying to unite people, I carried out a far right-wing agenda. I screwed up and let this attack of horrendous proportions occur on our soil. I started a needless illegal war that has killed tens of thousands of Iraqis and hundreds of Americans. I just blew it. I've blown it like I've blown everything in my life, from my business to my politics. And I'm just somehow want to make amends. He ought to be doing what Jimmy Carter is doing, right? You know, building houses, some way to talk about redemption, as we were earlier, to redeem himself. All right, let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter, how's it going?
Going well, thanks.
Hey, I hate to take you off topic, because I know that's kind of a pet peeve for you, but I heard a rumor at work, and I have to admit I'm kind of uninformed. I haven't had a chance to research it as much as I'd like to. But I guess Bush has a proposal coming out against overtime.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was, I think that's been beat back. I'm sorry, I didn't mention the working class, but that would affect the middle class as well. The Republicans, because, you know, their pals are the bosses and the corporations and what have you, they were trying to institute these new rules that would lessen overtime pay considerably for millions of Americans. Fortunately, enough Republicans, along with the Democrats, saw what this was, just another way to loot the wealth that labor creates, and voted it down. But no, they were going to do it. You're absolutely right.
Hey, and another thing I just wanted to kind of let you know of, searching around on eBay the other day, and there's a lady out of Kansas, I believe it is, that's selling anyone against Bush for 2004 election bumper stickers. Kind of wanted to pass it along to you.
No, that's good. I mean, but, you know, there are so many places. If you go to my website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com, and there's a drawing, what looks like a photograph, of this statue of Bush being pulled over, you know, the way they pulled over the statue of Saddam. And if you click on that, it goes to 5,000 anti-Bush websites, and tons of them have anti-Bush bumper stickers.
All right, thanks for clarifying that for me.
All right, thanks a lot. Yeah. I mean, every assault on our standard of living. You know that Bush never does anything in and of itself for itself? I mean, unless he's looting the Treasury and driving us into deficit and taking away people's rights and stuff like that. But in terms of actually doing things for the people of the United States, anybody name one of those things? Anyways, he went fishing the other day. I mean, here is Iraq exploding. I mean, this makes me nervous. The last time he went on vacation, it was the run-up to September 11th, when he wasn't focused on what's going on. But he was out he caught a big bass, caught the biggest one, fishing with, he was out with Roland Martin from Fishing with Roland Martin, the name of the show. And Bush, then he's running around with the NRA people as well. So it's all right wing. I mean, when they go on programs, they go on these far right wing talk shows, for instance. Why don't they come on this show? Let me bring them on. Anyways, Bush opened his expansive Central Texas ranch to sporting aficionados and conservation groups, including the National Rifle Association. So this is how you get paid off for supporting Bushco. Now, the NRA has given almost $400,000. to Bush for re-election. And this is according to the Center for Responsive Politics. So he's bringing all these people out there. So, you know, so why is he doing it? And why is he catching fish? Well, here it says. Bush has been courting the millions of voters who fish and hunt. So he's not even interesting. He's not even interested in fishing in and of itself. He's trying to snag votes. Just like he is the fundraiser in chief. I guess they finally stopped fundraising. He's made like $170 million from people that want to continue this process of looting the country from all his corporate buddies. So now they're finally, maybe he'll go back to what? Back to his ranch. I guess he did that. All right, let's continue onward. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening. Hey, you with me? No? All right, bye. Thank you, Jay. By the way, I should have said as well, Jay Hudson is our new producer and phone screener, so you will talk to him when you call 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
Good. Hey, I enjoy your show a lot. First time I've ever got to talk to you. It's kind of funny. You were talking about the hunters and all that who support Bush. Right now I'm driving behind a car that says Sportsman for Bush, which is, I thought that was kind of ironic. But anyway,
sure.
Getting back to my point, I'm 24 years old. I don't know a lot about politics or anything like that, but I just have a question. Do you think we as the United States have just become too powerful for our own good? And I'll kind of use a sports analogy for this because it's the only way I can understand it myself. Take a team like the Detroit Red Wings even, you know, a very powerful team. Once you become that good and that powerful, everyone starts gunning for you. And when the powerful team makes a victory, or in this case, the United States kills people, no one cares about it. But when you're able to get score a major win against a big powerhouse like that, then, you know, it's a big deal. And I just think that we have so much power, and we're only as good as our best competitor, which is practically no one.
Right.
So in that case, I just think that this continues and we do not change something, that within like a decade or so, like when I'm, you know, 35, 40 years old, we might have a lot of people against us, and then that may be when you get your next like huge world war.
Right now we've got a lot of people against us in this unnecessary war against Iraq, and now what's occurring even more, that we have engendered the most intense hatred for the United States, not just in the Muslim world, but among our traditional allies. We're despised by Canadians, and I don't mean so us as, I mean, let me get straight. And most people don't, like, hate us, the American people, but they despise the country that they see personified by George W. Bush. McLean's, which is this Canadian national publication, they did this poll, and something like 85% or more of Canadians said that they hope Bush loses. And in terms of what you're talking about, great empires, I'm trying to remember the exact title of this book. There's a conservative historian, Paul Kennedy, who wrote a book, oh man, who knows, might even have been 10 years ago or so, and it's called Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And everything that Portugal and Holland and Spain and England did to assure that they eroded their imperial base and hence created this enormous problems for themselves is being repeated by the United States. And these guys running things are clueless. They seem smart, you know, Cheney and Rumsfeld and Powell and Wolfowitz and all those characters, but they're leading us, they've got us in a handbasket to hell, that's for sure. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Ooh, thanks for correcting me on this. Ron called, and he's a member of NABIT CWA. That's the National Association. What is it? Oh, come on, Pete. You can't even remember your broadcast unions. We'll just call it NABIT, and Communication Workers of America, Local 43 here in Detroit. He says, you're wrong. The assault on overtime is still on. Bush has managed to blackmail even his own Republicans to keep them from overturning the Labor Department overtime changes that are screwing the middle and working classes. Now, thank you for correcting me. This was a Labor Department dictate, and so they in the way that Bush does. He knows he can't get a lot of this stuff through, and we're all concerned with gay marriage and stuff like that, so we're not paying attention when our pockets are being picked by Bush Co. So apparently this has not been resolved at all, and thanks to Ron from National Broadcast. What is it? Come on. National Association of Broadcast Engineers and Technicians? Is that what it is? Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks.
The horribly mangled sports metaphors. Your previous caller mentioned sports and world history, and that's exactly what Osama bin Laden did. He'd already bagged the number two bad boy in the world, a bear. Now he's coming after an eagle.
Yeah, there you go. Russia, then us.
And we helped create them.
Yeah, well, right, both of them. Both what became the Taliban and Osama bin Laden.
Before that, the Mujahideen.
Sure. You know, actually, if you're interested in that question, there is somebody, I can't remember when I'm going to interview him, next week or the week after, Craig Unger, and he's written a book called House of Bush, House of Saud, you know, from the Saudis, The Secret Relationship Between the World's Two Most Powerful Dynasties. And it talks about the relationship between the Bush family and that whole corrupt...
Ibn Fahd.
Yeah, that whole corrupt authoritarian monarchy that are the Bush buddies. Democracy in the Middle East. What a scam.
That was one thing that was glossed over in Clark's testimony was he did mention the fact that the U.S. government escorted the bin Laden family out of the country.
No, he did. Well, this is one of the things that Unger talks about, that after September 11th, on September 12th, was it?
It was relatively, it was the day after, it was during the no-fly ban.
Yeah, all the planes were grounded, but Bush ordered that all of the bin Laden family, of which were very prestigious, and there's like university chairs named after bin Laden. Osama's the bad boy. But they all tied in with the Bush family. They took all 140 of the people in the United States from the bin Laden family, picked them up in U.S. airplanes, brought them to Virginia, I believe it was, put them on a Saudi plane, and took them all out of the country. Now, there's no reason to suspect that any of them were involved in any of this, but there certainly has been enough financing. By the way, there's enough, there's people that are probably saying, oh, wait a minute, don't say that. But I'll leave that for the conspiracists. But anyways, these were people that were intimately connected to terrorist financing through the royal family, have the same last name as the man who was said to be behind all of this. And anyone knows that people at a connected to a crime scene, relatives and what have you, you talk to them. For one thing, you might say, hey, where's your cousin? Where's your cousin Osama? But none of that was. Bush made sure that every bin Laden family member, all 140 of them, were flown out of this country without a single interview.
Yep.
Yep. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Let's see. Jay Hudson is either giving me the peace sign or he's saying to go to line two. I think it's the latter here. If you're ringing, just be patient. Jay, we'll get to you in a second. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hello, Peter. This is Maurice. How you doing?
Maurice from Detroit. How are you?
I'm okay. Actually, from Inkster, but anyway,
okay.
I really believe, like you said, the connection between Bush and bin Laden in 9/11, with the Florida fiasco, with the election, with the illegal war to Afghanistan, and Iraq, I believe this country is making a lot of enemies. And I think the UN might put a resolution against this country to pull our power from us, eliminate our forces around the world, you know, airplanes and stuff like that. Because I think this country is getting a little bit too big for their fans.
Ah. Well, that certainly is a consideration. It ties into what we were saying a little earlier about these empires that overextend themselves. Thank you, Maurice. Warren says, the Jews didn't kill Jesus, people like you did. All right, Warren. All right, last, I'm close to, you're spamming me, dude. You're close to having your address blocked. So last email of the night, right? All right. Let's continue on. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, I saw a majority of people voted for Jesse Ventura, Schwarzenegger. I don't get what that means anything to you.
What's it?
A majority of people
voted for Arnold and for Jesse. Yeah. So that the majority of people in Minnesota and in California wanted these guys as their governors. Yeah.
Right.
That's called the democratic process.
Is that good?
Well, no, it's not good, but it's legitimate.
And when the thing in Florida happened, why did Gore want to get the military vote blocked off? The people that were overseas.
Well, there was so much scam going on with those as well. Look, I mean, Bush lost. Bush lost cold.
But he lost more than our forefathers said, change it. Why ain't the liberals trying to change it?
Trying to change
you got,
what?
You got California. You got more people in California. Why don't they change it? Our forefathers said, change it. If something's not working right, change it. How come no one's saying it now?
What do you mean, to change the Electoral College?
Yeah, we can do anything we want.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there hasn't been any move to change that whatsoever. I mean, look, Gore and Clinton just stood by when that election was stolen from them and didn't create a commotion. I mean, any political party worth its mettle would have called millions of people out into the streets and saying, hey, look, this horrendous theft of democracy has just occurred. Don't let it happen. Instead, like a couple of hangdogs, Gore and Clinton show up at the guy that stole the election's inauguration. I don't have much respect for them. All right, thank you. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening. Good evening. We've got that out of the way.
I was just going, I was reading Michael Moore's book, Dude, Where's My Country? And it talks about a lot of the issues about how Bush got the Bin Laden family out of the country. And it just asked a lot of real good questions. And I just wanted to put it out there to the listeners that that's a really good book to read if you want to look more into the 9/11 deal and everything else that goes on with the Bush family.
No, I agree. Well, how was my telling of it? I was, as I was telling the story, I was thinking I hadn't read about that in quite a while. Was it close to what Moore had, his account, as well as the way the Bin Ladens were taken out of the country by Bush?
Yeah, it talked about how they, it didn't, the whole no-fly zone didn't affect them, and they went from, I think, Texas to D.C. and then to out of the country when the FAA released the no-fly zone.
Yeah. I mean,
and
they,
as soon as they lifted it, they got them out of the country. So, but, yeah, I just think it's a real good book. I'm still reading it, so I haven't gotten through everything. But it's definitely a good book if you're looking to get some information about that.
Yeah, it's interesting to see. It's been on the bestseller list for, damn, like three-quarters of a year or something like
yeah.
that. Well, this book, this Craig Unger book, UNGER, House of Bush, House of Saud, is just blowing the lid off of things, and it's going up the list of the New York Times bestsellers as well. And well, it should. Yeah. Oh, yeah, here it says, how did the Bushes, America's most popular, or excuse me, the, let me start that again. How did the Bushes, America's most powerful political family, become gradually seduced by and entangled with their Saudi counterparts? Why did the Bush administration approve the secret airlift out of America of 140 Saudis, including two dozen relatives of Osama bin Laden, just after September 11th? All right, so there I was making a mistake. It wasn't 140 bin Ladens. It was 140 Saudis, including
right.
two dozen relatives of Osama. Did one of the Saudi royals on the planes have any advanced knowledge of the attacks? Now, this is absolutely amazing. Given their business relationship with the Saudis charged with financing Osama bin Laden's jihad, have the House of Bush's business interests compromised America's war on terror?
Right. Right. Yeah, he let them go, and the FBI wanted to talk with them, and he allowed them to leave the country because fear for their safety.
Yeah. The senator from New York, Charles Schumer, said about the evacuation of the Saudis. This is just another example of our country coddling the Saudis and giving them special privileges that others would never get.
Yep,
exactly. It's almost as if we didn't want to find out what links existed.
Right, yeah. Bush wanted to keep it all under the table so that we didn't find out that he was in business with these people.
You know, I actually someone asked me, and I didn't want to answer last week for different reasons, but if I could ask how old you are?
I'm 22.
Okay. What, you know, when a year ago, when all of this stuff was coming out about the so-called weapons of mass destruction, I said, you know, in about 30 or 40 years, when I was saying, if somebody would have said they were 22, you know, when you're like a grandfather and stuff like that, and this is what I said a year ago, and it's going to come out that there weren't any weapons of mass destruction and there never were any. I said, you're going to remember, yeah, back around the turn of the century, there was this talk show host, I can't remember his name, that said that was true. But it turned out that we found this out in just about 6 months, and I think that all of the corruption, all of the lies of the Bush administration are going to come out real quickly. Like it took like 60 years to find out the lies about World War I, 100 years to find out about the lies about the Spanish-American Wars, and probably 30 years to find out about the lies about the Vietnam War, except, things are moving quickly. And I think this, I would just like to see this whole Bush gang, Bush Co., as I call them, just unravel to the point where they would have some common decency and all resign.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's coming out that this fast because there are a lot of unanswered questions that people need to know and everybody should know, but they're not answering any of the questions that we need to know.
No, Michael Moore's book is a good place to start. I agree.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Here's something. I got this email a little earlier, and this is from Kim listening in Denver. And she said she was the one that wrote about the horrible Canadian seal hunt. Perhaps you could mention what a crime the sealing is and ask people to write letters to the addresses at cshepherd.org. Cshepherd.org. Yeah, this is incredible. Remember, years ago, Captain Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherds stopped the sealing where these men would come out in the ice floes and there's these cuddly little baby harp seals and they would club them on the head, skin them, and take the seal skin? Well, why in the hell they began this again is absolutely beyond me. The whole industry is unprofitable. And, Kim, you are absolutely right. You think of Canada as this gentle country, and the Canadian government has spent millions to subsidize the killing of these poor little cute little harmless animals. They got something. They're eating all the fish. So what is it, the seals? So I can't remember what kind of stupid arguments they have. But, man. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on how misguided our values have become. I mean, if you look at the basic teaching of Christianity, turn the other cheek, do unto your neighbor as you would have done unto you. I want to know how that turned into get your neighbor before they get you. It's just it's screwed up, and I'm just wondering when this continual escalation and just continual circle of violence is how it's going to just continue like this.
Yeah, and we don't know. I mean, here now, Bush says that they're, and these commanders in Iraq say they're going to quickly suppress all of this. And gee, doesn't it sound like, 40 years ago in Vietnam, we just need a few more troops, and it's just a small minority of the population that's against us, and what have you. I mean, the analogy isn't perfect, but, in fact, what it's more like is the Israeli incursion into Beirut in 1982, where thousands and thousands of Lebanese and Palestinian civilians were killed. As we talk, I guess they have a ceasefire going now, but this massacre has occurred of the people who we're supposed to be liberating.
Yeah, I mean, even Rumsfeld said himself, I mean, we need to, prevent more terrorists than we're creating. I don't see how the mindset is that if you attack a population, that's going to make them like you more.
No, I think...
create less terrorists.
Yeah, no, we are creating just an unimaginable number of terrorists. And I don't know if you heard me read earlier that account of these... of the hatred that these Iraqis now have for the United States. And you can only think, and for better or for worse, they can be, you know, Bremer calls them two-bit thugs or religious fanatics or a small percentage of the population, whatever. There's 600 people dead. The Americans say they're mostly fighters. The Iraqis say they're women and children, whatever they are. Imagine if in Detroit, in particular neighborhoods, 600 people were killed by occupiers, what the families and friends, and even those of us who didn't know them but knew them as fellow Detroiters, what the kind of antipathy we would have towards the people that carried it out. This could be the good old days. I mean, you got to remember, that's what happened in Vietnam. Skirmishes, and all we need is another 10,000 troops, another 50,000 troops, another 100,000 troops. Except according to Barry McCaffrey, who was one of the generals of the first Gulf War, he says there ain't troops there to bring. There's not troops there to bring for reinforcements. Great going, Bush. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Ryan from Redford, I said that the United States ought to just get the hell out of there. He says, I don't think getting out is the answer. He wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. What will we leave behind? Iraq is fighting for an identity with religious tensions mounting between people. We shouldn't have gone about this as a takeover, but now that we have, it's our responsibility to see that this country doesn't go into civil warfare. Well, yeah, that was always the fear, that there would be this civil war, Ryan, between the Shiites and the Sunnis and the Turkmen and the Kurds. Well, now it looks like it's going to be united opposition against the United States. If American soldiers leave, says Ryan, I believe Iraqis will find new enemies within their own borders. So, no, we can't leave, but we do need to work for Iraqi civilians and improve their quality of life. Work with them. Well, to some extent, that's what they've been trying to do. You know, we're spending our billions that could best be used here, although I think we owe the Iraqis rebuilding their country since we destroyed it unnecessarily. On the other hand, we bought them all these police cars, right? We bought them all these police cars, and as soon as anything came down, boom, they're out of there. They just left. They gave the police cars over to the Iraqi insurgents. So they're in the Iraqi insurgents in many of these places are driving cop cars that you and I paid for. Isn't that sweet? Also, a battalion of the new Iraqi army refused to go to Fallujah earlier this week to support U.S. Marines, and so it was the first time U.S. commanders have sought to involve the post-war Iraqi army in major combat operations. Members of the battalion insisted during the discussions, we did not sign up to fight Iraqis. He declined to characterize the incident. This was some American commander here. He said, U.S. Army Major General Paul Eaton, who's overseeing the development of security forces. Eaton declined to characterize the incident as a mutiny, but rather called it, quote, a command failure. So, I don't know, his? But they refused to go into battle. This is when the U.S. Army began unraveling, disintegrating in Vietnam. That's one of the reasons they ended the war. I mean, there were so many mutinies, fraggings, killing of officers, Americans killing their own officers that were too gung-ho, that the fear was, and people put it in these terms in Vietnam, that it wasn't we were going to lose the war, we were going to lose our army. So it looks like they're losing the Iraqi army, and the Iraqi army is paid for by you and I. Your tax dollars, my tax dollars, have gone to provide uniforms and weapons and their pay. Isn't that sweet? All right, let's continue on. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number here at Night Call. I'm Peter Werby, and let's see. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. I've been listening for about the last hour and 20 minutes, and not one time have I heard the word oil mentioned during this entire conversation. And I'm here to tell you that the only reason that any of this is going on is because the world now is at what has been recognized by most petroleum geologists, for example, the beginning of peak oil and gas. The world is simply running out of oil, the Bush administration, my greatest fear is they're going to tell the truth to the American public, and that is the reason for this expedition in the first place always was to secure the oil that this economy needs in order to continue to move in the direction that it's going. I think you've interviewed Michael Rupert before from the wilderness, and a while ago he printed out the last few lines of the movie 3 Days of the Condor when Cliff Roberts and the Selling Robert Redford, what do you think Americans are going to do when their houses are cold and they don't have any food and their cars are stuck on the express? He said, they're going to want us to go get the stuff.
Sure.
And that's exactly what this is all about. And until people come to grips with that reality, all of this stuff is really kind of moot.
Well, let me say that what you're saying does have a lot of importance to it. I've interviewed before, let me see, what's the name of the book? The Party's Over, Peak Oil by Richard Heinberg, H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G. And there's some stuff on my site about, actually, I don't think about, I keep meaning to put Heinberg's site on there because that's extraordinarily important. And sure, the oil reserves that exist, which are the second largest in the world, under Iraq are something that that these neocons covet greatly. And this is the idea that we'll maintain as long as possible this absolutely awful source of energy, oil. And you know, you're right. I mean, I think there's lots of other things involved, but oil is certainly up there.
Could I just mention one other thing? You made mention a while ago about a duck hunting with Scalia. This is what people should know about what that whole thing is about. The Supreme Court is about to make a decision determining whether or not the Cheney Bush junta have to release the documents that were accumulated during what is called the National Energy Policy Development Group.
Right.
And most people think that the reason that they're trying to sequester that information is because they want to know what buddies were doled out this part of the pie. Well, that's got nothing to do with what they're trying to conceal. What the Bush administration is attempting to conceal is the first recognition by the United States administration of peak oil, and that there is no place that the United States knows where to come up with the 8.6 million barrels a day shortfall that we are experiencing now for our energy consumption is going to come from. And Iraq was looking like a place where that was going to be part of, but it ends up that Iraq's oil fields are way, way less profligate than anybody originally or was continuing to imagine. They're very degraded. On a daily basis, this is something people don't know, that every single day, in order to maintain pressures sufficient to get oil out of the ground, 200,000 barrels of oil are pumped back into the ground every day in order to make sufficient pressure levels maintained in the oil wells there.
Yeah, this is typical of the Bush administration going in absolutely the wrong direction. At 1 a.m. Eastern time, which is just in a little bit, I'm going to be interviewing Tyson Slocum of the, who's, I think, I can't remember exactly his title, but he works with Public Citizen. And we're going to talk about gasoline prices and what have you. And they've got some stuff on my website as well. Thank you for your comments. I appreciate it.
The Riff.
say a lot of stuff that they know I'll disagree with, and then I don't have any. Well, I mean, I could read it and talk, but no, you know, no to remailer. So, Paul, if you want to email me directly at calltalkyes at yahoo.com, I'll read your stuff on the air, but not through a remailer. Sorry. Oh, yeah, here too. Let me see. Is this signed? Joshua. Yeah. Do you think that Bushco might consider reinstating the draft if they win the 2004 elections? What are your thoughts? And it would be great if you could mention our site, which is Insight. I'm sorry. I said it wrong. Insight. Insight.matrixflux.com. Insight.matrixflux.com. They do a lot of discussion on there. And that also is on my website because people haven't been sending me that many lately. I used to have them all right on the front page, that all being listener website. So if you have your own site, you're hosting a site and you're talking about the kind of things that we talk about in this broadcast, you can send it to me at calltalkyes at yahoo.com. Calltalkyes at yahoo.com. And you go to the site and you can see how we put them up on there. So glad to do it. And then if you put me on yours, I appreciate that. All right, let's continue on. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. It's so good to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
I'm from Ann Arbor, and I'm in the middle of the liberal world here. That nasty word.
Yeah.
I just wanted to tell you that I haven't heard you speak anything about John Dean's book, Worse Than Watergate.
Oh, yeah. John Dean, of course, who was a flack for another one of those big Republican liars and crooks, Richard Nixon, has a new book out. Yeah.
And he's devoting quite a bit of time talking about the secrecy aspects of this White House and how he has never seen anything like it in history. And I was fortunate to see him testify the first time around at Watergate hearings.
Really?
Yeah, and he was very articulate. And he is still very articulate. And I hope that somehow you can bring up some things if you get a chance to read his book about that.
Yeah, the book, I've seen interviews with him. One of the websites that I try to get people to read, because I read it myself, is buzzflash.com. They have an interview there with him. In fact, I wonder if it's, I might even have it on my site. I'll take a look in a minute. I don't know what's on there myself. There's so much.
Yeah, well, he has been speaking in several of the talk shows, and he is quite amazing. He tears into the situation as well as you do. But anyway, I have a comment I'd like to make.
Sure. Maybe I should write a book.
I think you should.
Okay.
You might have to write more than one.
Okay.
I know why Cheney and Bush have to testify together.
Why?
So that they can't get caught saying different things from each other.
Yeah.
Because that's how they kept trying to catch Clinton and how the people were brought down at Watergate. So they've done their history very well.
Well, the idea that Bush can't even testify by himself is testimony in and of itself, as how limited in capacity the man is, that he is just a sock puppet for Cheney.
That's right.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
Well, I have one more thing.
Oh, sure.
This is on the lighter side. Whenever you hear Bush saying things in his good old boy country folk way, just remember that he's talking as stupidly to you as he thinks you are.
Well, there you go. Hey, by the way, I just went to my own website. My last name is spelled W-E-R-B-E. So it's peterwerbe.com.
Yes.
And there's an interview with John Dean. Dean says that Bush should be impeached. And his book is called Worse Than Watergate.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. It's Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
Good.
Good to talk to you. First of all, let me start out by saying thanks a lot again for being the sole voice of sanity of the Detroit media landscape.
Well, it's not
every week.
Thank you, but it's really not to my credit. It's to the discredit of the media here and across the country that they don't have jillions of people like me on here because, well, let's get some real figures in here. There's tens of millions of people that think like me and that can say the things that I say, right?
But unfortunately, they don't. The people who think like you don't own Clear Channel. So,
right.
there we go. I wanted to talk just first about a couple things. First of all, I've loved your commentary tonight on Paul Bremer and the nature of the man being the fascist that he is. Basically, the parallels that people have been starting to talk about, starting with Teddy Kennedy, about Iraq and Nam, I think, are more than slightly startling. And I think, I don't know if anyone's brought up yet that Fallujah is more or less the moral equivalent of My Lai. But to me, that's one of the strongest resonances so far on that front.
Hmm.
And for people who don't know what My Lai is, I think if you want an example of American military moral bankruptcy at its worst, something currently being reenacted on a daily basis in Iraq, all you have to do is look that up.
Well, let me just say something a little about My Lai. My Lai, of course, was this massacre of mostly women and children and elderly by William Calley at this village called My Lai. It was, and we found out, too, there's this, what was it called, the Tiger Brigade or the Tiger Unit, the Toledo Blade reporter that exposed that through the information that he picked up at the Labadie collection at the University of Michigan, that there was this sustained... actions on the part of this U.S. unit of murderous activity. Now, you really have to go to Apocalypse Now and understand that not just the ordinary madness of war. I mean, it's one thing if there's this frontal warfare where you have the American Army versus the Japanese Army, and there was enough atrocities on both sides and killing of prisoners and what have you because of the intense hatred that the armies work up for one another. On the other hand, it's even worse when you put people into a situation like the men of a generation ago were put into in Vietnam, where why did people like Callie, who was just an ordinary guy from some town, wherever, suddenly, and enough other people in his unit willing to open up their M14s on or M16s, whatever they had, on women and children and elderly? How could they do that? How could they be that inhuman? Well, after being put in this absolutely unreasonable, untenable position by presidents and by generals and by politicians, well, it brought out the absolute worst in people. Brings out what they're the most capable of doing in an awful manner. In other words, if William Calley, instead of being a mass murderer, had been left at home, who knows? He might have ran his dad's feed store or whatever the hell his family did. Or he might have become a lawyer or something like that. Same thing here. The Americans there, after they've seen their friends and their comrades in the 101st Airborne and the Marines and what have you, blown apart, they've seen these bodies hanging there, they must just be boiling with a hatred for Iraqis. And so when someone says, just, shoot into this urban area, there's not even a second thought. So, it's a lot. I'm not trying to let anybody off the ethical hook, because Buffy St. Marie's song, which is still always applies in my mind, Universal Soldiers, the orders come from far away no more. Ultimately, who is responsible for this? And it's the men in the White House. It's the men in the Pentagon. I mean, you put in the men in the Pentagon. They were ordered by the men in the White House.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. This is Kevin from Romulus.
Hi, Kevin.
I enjoy your show, and I called him because I had a comment, especially about your other caller who called about the oil issue,
mm-hmm.
and I just wanted to add something to that.
Sure.
I happened to read something in the New York Times probably within the last 6 months or so. I don't remember the exact month or day, but they had somebody who was very knowledgeable about that whole business, and this is what that person said. He said that the oil production of Iraq, and it's borne out to be true, is less than 2 million barrels of oil a day. And that person said that if we had lowered the speed limit all over the United States, that means every single state was down to 55 miles an hour, our oil savings would be over 3 million barrels a day, and thereby eliminating the need for any kind of adventure that we're having.
Well, actually, that's what you're stealing the thunder from my guest, who's going to be on in a few minutes. But, yeah, no, I think that's good to say. But, you know, the Sammy Hagar song, I Can't Drive 55.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's kind of funny because, I mean, I guess, I mean, it just shows human behavior because I drive on the freeway every morning, and I have yet to see anybody doing 70. I mean, when it says 70, people are doing 80.
Sure.
I mean, I have yet to see. I mean, I'm going 70, and people look at me like I'm a jerk, you know? Like I'm somebody who doesn't know how to drive.
No, I agree with you. I go, when my wife makes me drive the speed limit, and I'll be going 70 miles an hour, and, I mean, I got to drive in the right-hand lane.
Right. And I just had one more point, and then I'm going to get off the air.
Sure.
Maybe it also we need to question our own behavior and our own habits. Because really, I mean, we are empowering people who are unaccountable to anybody, who make decisions that end up killing all of us or hurting or damaging us, both in the economy and in every sense of the word. I mean, do we ever examine our own behavior? Because, I mean, we sit here in Michigan, and, I mean, let's be honest about it. I mean, we sit here in Michigan, and in the middle of December, we want fresh oranges, and they're being flown in from somewhere,
mm-hmm.
being trucked in from somewhere. Do we realize the consequences of our buying habits? Because we're fostering all that oil dependence. We're fostering all that pollution, all that damage to the environment. Because we want everything now, no matter what season, where, why, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's like we got to have everything that's totally logical that probably a generation ago here did not even have.
Sure, you got to have those flowers from Colombia.
Right.
Yeah. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your call. Let's see, Kurt writes in, I just want to say I love your show and your website. I listen to your show every week. I just wanted to say that NPR, which is National Public Radio, is a great source of news. Well, Kurt, I'll get to your last line. I think it's often a good source of news. I know you said it was National Puppet Radio. Just listen sometime. I listen all the time. You'll hear stories you won't hear from the corporate media. That's absolutely true. And now... you know, you can now that the media is actually being somewhat critical of the Bush regime, Bushco, they are getting some decent stuff on there. But during the run-up to the war, that's when I was saying we called it National Puppet Radio and Nationalistic Pentagon Radio, because it repeated the same lies without any attempt to give a balanced view, a fair and balanced view, if you will, of the millions of people that knew that Bush's charges against Iraq were nothing but lies. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, my name's Chuck. I'm glad to get on the air.
Thanks, Chuck.
I want to talk to you because I've been working on this theory, I think, about explaining why we're in Iraq, and I'd like to lay it on you and see what you think.
Sure.
Okay, first of all, I think President Bush saw like 9/11 as an opportunity for him. I think he has a vision of reinvigorating America's military-industrial complex like in the 50s and 60s during the Cold War.
Uh-huh.
I think he has a goal of driving the economy through massive military spending. But the political reality of things is he can't spend the money until he gets Congress to approve a budget.
Sure.
So, okay, he can't say to the American people, we're going to spend more than ever before, and you should feel safer as a result of it. So he figures he needs the American military waging a campaign somewhere. The Army needs to be out kicking somebody's butt, dropping bombs somewhere, doing something, so the American people say, hey, at least he's trying something.
Well, one
That's
of the,
where Iraq comes in.
Yeah, I think you're onto something, and it goes even deeper. I don't know, are you familiar with the Carlyle Group?
Not that familiar. But.
Okay. The Carlyle Group is this consortium of different countries, and people involved in it include GW's dad, the ex-prime minister of England, lots of other people from the Reagan and Bush administration, and a lot of their holdings are in weapons. I mean, they're pretty extensive in a lot of other things as well. So our tax dollars go to the Carlyle Group to destroy Iraq, and then Bush's buddies in like Cheney's company, Halliburton, and Bechtel, who are real big on having the war, then they get paid to rebuild Iraq with our tax dollars that the Carlyle Group got paid with our tax dollars to destroy. Isn't that a sweet little racket?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let me end this one quickly because I got to get some final calls. Thanks a lot, Chuck. Appreciate it. And let me see here. Okay. Thank you, Jay. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
How you doing? I just wanted to mention two things. One is 27 American soldiers have committed suicide in Iraq since the start of the war.
That's right. It's awful.
They've never had that high of a number before in our history so early on in the war. And the other thing I want to talk about is the fact that, you know, these tax cuts, like people like O'Reilly and Chris Matthews and all these guys supposedly, you know, obviously don't say anything about Bush, but they're the ones who are benefiting from this tax break.
Sure.
So why would they talk out against them?
Well, I know.
I mean it's almost like he's paying his own court.
Well, if you think about somebody like Rush Limbaugh, who, I forgot what his contract was. It was about like a quarter of $1 billion. I mean, he makes a fortune off of Bush's tax cuts, and then he gets invited to play golf with him, and he gets to sleep in the White House. Now, when John Kerry gets elected, assuming that there will be elections and assuming that they'll let the winner this time take office, if all of a sudden I started sleeping at the White House and playing golf with John Kerry, and then got on the air and started defending every single thing that Kerry ever did, wouldn't you be a little suspicious of me?
I'd be a little suspicious.
Yeah.
You know, he reminds me a lot of King Louis XIV. You know, he's almost got his own absolute power because the executive power is now higher than both branches. There
sure.
actually is no balance of power in this country anymore.
Yeah.
And the Patriot Act and things like he's used 9/11 to create fear and order, and there's no judiciary review, and this guy is just running rampant and they're representing us and totally destroying our images in the world. We went from Clinton was the most highly regarded worldwide president we've ever had to the most hated president we've ever had worldwide.
He is
and
hated.
And I think there's something going on there.
You know, I think there's even a website called heishated.com. All right, thank you very much for being our last caller. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Got a couple of great interviews coming. One about... why we're paying so much for gas at the pump. That's next on Night Call.
Okay, so now my friend Barry wants to buy a motorcycle, a really big motorcycle. But he's a working guy, trying like me to pinch his pennies. Then all our friends told Barry, buy a bike at Motown, buy a bike at Motown. So Barry, who stays home nights pinching his pennies, thinks he can get the better deal if he shops the competition. Those other dealers showed him what he could get with his pennies. And then his head explodes. Then I take my friend Barry to Motown, Harley Davidson, and Taylor. They tell him, big used police bike, save today. And he says, no way. And they say, save today. And he says, no way. And they say, save today. And Larry says, okay. And now we are riding our Harleys, and Barry has his macho, macho motorcycle and didn't have to part with all his pennies. The end.
For sales, specials, events, or just to look at cool pictures, log on to MotownHarley.com. Motown Harley Davidson in Taylor on Telegraph, just north of Eureka.
Remember, guys, chicks stick a guy on the real motorcycle. Buy a bike at Motown! Okay. The party just doesn't stop at Leopard's Lounge and Broil, Windsor's number one gentleman's club. Every week at Leopard's Lounge, they bring you new girls from all over the world, so it never gets boring. And these girls are hot. Plus, unlike other gentlemen's clubs, at Leopard's Lounge, you never pay a cover charge, ever. They even have free parking. It's the best entertainment value around. This Tuesday night, join Mike Walters from the Riff's Drew and Mike Show for a special Tuesday night Riff Bash. Mike will have tons of giveaways and lots of other special surprises. Come on, guys. You work hard. You deserve a night out. So make sure you make it to Leopard's Lounge and enjoy the finer things in life. You know what I'm talking about. Beer and sexy, beautiful women from all around the world. We'll see you this Tuesday night at Leopard's Lounge in Windsor for a special Riff party. Just 5 minutes from the bridge or tunnel at 1190 Wyandotte West. Call 1-888-653-8881 for Leopard's Lounge and Broil.
Credit Union One happily presents The Clumsy Giant.
Welcome to my home, little friends.
You tore off the door, Clumsy Giant.
Whoa! Now you put your foot through the roof.
Well, I better fix all this with Credit Union One's low-interest home equity line of credit. No annual fee, no minimum draw or prepayment penalty, and interest as low as...
Don't say it!
1.99%.
Here comes Legal Beagle!
Bow wow, what a rate!
This introductory 1.99 annual percentage rate applies to new home equity lines of credit only, effective on date of your first draw. It continues at that rate for 90 days, then reverts to prime. Other rates available subject to change. You must take first draw by June 30th. This is a variable rate loan subject to qualification. You must be a Credit Union One member and anyone can join. Apply online at CUONA.org or call 1-800-441-8999. But hurry, you must apply by May 31st. Right, Clumsy Giant?
You boys are him to sleep, Lego Beagle.
Bad dog.
Credit Union One, where you matter. Member NCUA.
Why are men all over America talking about testosterone? Listen.
I am 59 years old. I've been taking the testosterone product, and I feel better than I did 25 years ago.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. In many men, testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35. But now there's testosterone, the complete performance-boosting system I designed for men who are starting to feel their age. If you don't feel like the man you used to be, call now for a 30-day risk-free trial of the testosterone system, which includes my bonus report on aging and its effects on energy and sex drive, free with your order.
Call now for your confidential trial of testosterone. 1-888-207-9725. 1-888-207-9725. Guaranteed to work for you or your money back. 1-888-207-9725. 1-888-207-9725. Results will vary.
Come into Southgate Ford today and take advantage of their April sale prices. Southgate Ford is located on 4th Street, just south of Eureka in Southgate. Southgate Ford has great prices and customer cash rebates on the new 2004 F-150. Or how about a brand new Explorer, a Taurus, or a Focus? Southgate Ford in Southgate has it all and is now offering cash back, low APR, and lease specials. They're all here at Southgate Ford. Plus the lowest prices and best selection of new cars and trucks in the area. And don't forget, Southgate Ford guarantees AXE plan customers exact AXE plan pricing with no hidden extras. Southgate Ford is Downriver's number one Ford dealer in sales and service. Remember, you won't know if you have your best price until you check out the exact AXE plan pricing at Southgate Ford. Check out Southgate Ford's April specials and prices in the News Herald newspaper. Come on into Southgate Ford today and drive away in the best deal in town. Southgate Ford, conveniently located at 16501 4th Street, just minutes off I-75.
Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby, on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Thank you very much for joining me. I was coming over here to the radio station to record this interview and went by the, it hurts, the gas station and paid something like $1.81 a gallon for regular. Certainly not the highest here in the United States, but it goes up and up and up, and I think it's important to know why. Usually we just think, oh, well, you know, there's less oil, so, you know, supply and demand, all that stuff. Joining me is Tyson Slocum. He is the research director of Public Citizen's Energy Program, Public Citizen begun years and years ago by Ralph Nader, and Tyson Slocum, who has been on this show before. I want to welcome you back. Hi, Tyson.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good. And you've just finished, it was your authorship, and Public Citizen has published, Mergers, Manipulation, and Mirages, How Oil Companies Keep Gasoline Prices High and Why the Energy Bill Doesn't Help. That's quite a mouthful, but it kind of says it all. Well, thanks for joining us. I was only kidding. Most people think this is all, you know, all oil prices and gasoline prices are driven by the old, what we learned in high school economics, supply and demand, right? Free market. Not quite, huh?
No, because we do not have free markets in oil or gasoline markets. I mean, first of all, there's a international production cartel. It's not as powerful as it once was, but OPEC still openly colludes with other OPEC member states to dictate the price of oil. So the price of crude oil is not set by free market forces. And as we are painfully learning here in the United States, the retail price of gasoline is also not set by market forces, because we have allowed so many recent mergers, Peter, between large vertically integrated oil companies like Exxon and Mobil and Chevron and Texaco. They've all been allowed to merge with one another, that we've got completely uncompetitive gasoline markets here in the United States. Just to give you an example of the kind of consolidation I'm talking about, a decade ago, before all these mergers, the top five oil refiners only controlled a third of oil refinery capacity. Today, they control over half. And the top 10 control almost 80% of all the oil refineries.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that kind of control over the oil refineries provides companies like ExxonMobil is the ability to manipulate supplies to drive up prices.
Remind
and it's
us
not just it's not just consumer groups coming to this conclusion. I mean, the federal government, the last time it investigated this 3 years ago in March of 2001, the United States Federal Trade Commission, which is the government agency in charge of enforcing antitrust laws and protecting consumers, found that gasoline companies and oil refiners were intentionally withholding supplies from the marketplace to drive prices up. And if I could quote you a line from this study, if that's okay.
Yeah.
The study concluded, quote, an executive of a major oil company made clear that he would rather sell less gasoline and earn a higher margin on each gallon sold than sell more gasoline and earn a lower margin, end quote.
Now, is this from the Federal Trade Commission or your study?
That's from the Federal Trade Commission.
Okay.
This is the official investigation by federal regulators into why gasoline prices are high.
Now, before we get too far down the line, though, remind us what vertical integration means.
Sure. Sorry. Vertical integration, in the case of a company like ExxonMobil, is that it owns and controls oil and production facilities where they're actually extracting the oil from the ground. They also own the refineries that are turning that crude oil into refined products like gasoline. And they own retail establishments where you drive down the street corner and fill up your car at an Exxon or a Mobil gas station. That is vertical integration. You know, just like the old Rockefeller Standard Oil empire at the turn of the 20th century, when literally one company owned all stages of production. And we're seeing a resurgence of that now with all the recent mergers, so that the largest five oil companies control 48% of domestic oil production, which
now,
is really huge because the United States is the third largest oil producing country in the world.
Now,
yes.
Yeah, I was going to say that if this control enables oil companies to manipulate prices by, as you said, the Federal Trade Commission finding that they had intentionally withheld supplies, doesn't this violate U.S. federal statutes? Why aren't they in court?
Because it's not illegal in America today to intentionally withhold gasoline or natural gas or electricity from consumers.
Well, why? I mean, that doesn't seem to make a bit of sense. I mean,
it makes no sense at all, and that's why one of the seven recommendations that we've come up with is to make it illegal to withhold a product for the sole purpose of driving prices up. It would seem like that's a pretty reasonable position, right, Peter? But it is very difficult to get the political establishment to agree with us. And I think, you know, for the same reason that Ken Lay remains a free man, I think that the enormous political and financial influence that the oil industry enjoys in Washington, D.C., has bought the industry a certain amount of immunity from adequate scrutiny.
You know,
you got to remember, the oil and gas industry has contributed over $67 million since 2000 to federal candidates, with almost 80% of that going to Republicans.
Well, you know, Tyson Slocum, when you mentioned Ken Lay, and rather than the man's name being a household name in the way that Monica Lewinsky was during the Clinton administration, is that it should be equally during the Bush regime, yet they've successfully just swept that in Enron. That's who he was. That was who Bush used to call Kenny Boy. But now,
Now
I don't think he takes his calls anymore. There has been a series of scandals around energy production and sales, and Enron, which should have been the biggest, got swept away. But also there is Vice President Cheney's Energy Commission, or his energy, what was that called?
The task force.
The
yeah.
task force that now there's still, and is Public Citizen, your organization, is one of the plaintiffs in the suit against the vice president, am I correct?
Right. One of our lawyers, Alan Morrison, actually is the lead attorney on that lawsuit that was originally filed by two organizations, the Sierra Club and the ultra-conservative Judicial Watch.
That's right.
Judicial Watch, as you may remember, was actually directly responsible for getting Clinton impeached. The organization was formed by right-wing financial backers to pursue a lot of the Watergate or the Whitewater and other scandals of the Clinton administration. So this is not a left issue going after the secretive Cheney Energy Task Force. the left and the right are united in their desire to have accountability and transparency in our government.
Now, and this was a meeting where Cheney and unknown persons, it could have been Ken Lay, of course, sat down and were going to write an energy bill. Is it unusual to have, A, the vice president involved in such an undertaking? And secondly, is it unusual to have it be secret?
Absolutely. It is unprecedented for it to be so secret. And actually, it wasn't just one meeting. It was a series of meetings over several months. In which the Cheney Energy Task Force met with top energy company CEOs and other executives like Ken Lay to help the administration formulate and write its energy policy. And the reason why the public deserves more information and detail about how that energy policy was developed, because it is crucial for an understanding of how laws get implemented, to find out who had access, who had influence during the creation of our federal laws. And without that kind of information, we do not have a transparent government, and without a transparent government, I don't think we have a fully functioning democracy. This is not a witch hunt. This is a basic constitutional right of the people to have full accountability over their elected officials. And it has already been confirmed, because Dick Cheney voluntarily disclosed that he had six private meetings with Ken Lay, but he has refused to divulge what was talked about during those meetings. And we think it is entirely relevant for our democracy to know what was discussed during those private meetings, because they were on the public's time.
Now, the defense, one of the Cheney defenses, is that they also spoke with environmental groups as well. So they spoke with people across the board with a variety of concerns, and to have to make public the who was at them and what was said, they say it the opposite way. That interferes with the process of decision-making and lawmaking.
Absolutely not. I mean, first of all, environmental groups were not invited until 3 days before the Energy Task Force released its report. So it literally was an afterthought. And the environmental groups all had to be satisfied with having a meeting on one afternoon with all of them together, whereas we know that executives like Ken Lay had one-on-one personal private meetings with the vice president. So there clearly was not balance in the way that the administration solicited its input. And the whole argument that this is executive privilege is not going to stand up in the Supreme Court. And you've heard it here first, that the Supreme Court will rule against the Bush administration. Remember, every single lower court has ruled against the Bush administration's argument that this is executive privilege. It doesn't stand up to the legal tests that have already been presented before courts, and the Supreme Court is going to throw it out, and it's going to order the Bush administration to open up the files that it should have done 3 years ago to the public that deserves that kind of accountability.
Any chance it'll come before the election?
Yes, it will come before the election, but then the question is, how will the documents be delivered? Already, the Bush administration has been very slow to deliver documents that other courts have already ordered them to release. So they've been very slow in complying with a lot of these court orders. So even though the Supreme Court will rule probably by this summer that will force the administration to turn over documents, there might need to be another Supreme Court decision to force the administration to comply with that order.
You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show, and I'm talking today with Tyson Slocum. He's from Public Citizen, and he's the research director for Public Citizen's Energy Program. Citizen.org is where you can find their recently released report, Mergers, Manipulation, and Mirages, How Oil Companies Keep Gasoline Prices High and Why the Energy Bill Does Not Help. Well, let's go to some of the other objections. Some of them border on the racist, that it's actually the Arabs who are causing our high gasoline prices. Well, let's start with that one, and I'll shoot a couple more at you as we go along.
Sure. Well, actually, Middle Eastern OPEC nations only supply the United States with 15% of our daily crude oil consumption. You have to remember that the United States is the third largest crude oil producing country in the world, right? We produce about 5.8 million barrels of oil a day. Only Saudi Arabia and Russia produce more oil than us. But we use 25% of the world's daily oil production. So we are by far the largest oil consumer. So that's why we are only able to produce 37% of our daily needs. Even if we produced, Peter, as much as Saudi Arabia did every day, we would still be importing most of our oil. So, and then when you look at the other countries that supply us with oil, we get 34% of our daily oil from allies like Canada, Mexico, Norway, the United Kingdom, Colombia. So we're getting huge amounts of our oil, 85%, from non-Middle Eastern OPEC countries.
Well, what is it? I was just going to interrupt you real quickly to say, what does that do to the argument that many people, including myself, put forth that that the war against Iraq wasn't for any of the quickly disappearing rationalizations that the administration puts out, but rather was for control of Iraqi oil? If it's only
there's no question that Iraq, because it holds the world's second largest reserves, is a strategic is of strategic importance in the Middle East. And the whole Bush administration, the real reason behind the war, as we now know, it had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. The only reason they mentioned weapons of mass destruction was because that was the only way that the American people were going to support such a war. If the Bush administration had come out and said, look, we have this theory, this domino theory, where if we're able to get a democratic, free Iraq in the heart of the Middle East, and with control of that oil going to the West, there will be a domino of autocratic rulers in Saudi Arabia and Oman and Kuwait that will fall as a result of the democratic influence in Iraq. If they had tried to sell the American public on that theory, the American public would not have supported a preemptive strike.
Well, they
They had to they had to sell up this lie that there were ties to Al-Qaeda and that there were weapons of mass destruction in order to satisfy this plan. And so no question that oil plays a big role in the strategic importance of Iraq. I don't think that we fought the war for oil necessarily, but there's no question that Iraq's oil reserves play a big role.
Well, let's go to another objection. The gas would be a lot cheaper if it wasn't for you darn environmentalists like me and you, Tyson Slocum, and public citizen demanding that during the summer, for instance, that it be refined differently. So you take a lot of the blame for those darn environmentalists as being partly responsible for the rise of prices.
Yeah, the sensible public health laws that we have regarding the cleaner blends of gasoline have nothing to do with the price spikes that are going on right now. Those Clean Air Act requirements have actually led to much cleaner air in Milwaukee, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in Houston, and in New York, and other areas that have been forced to implement that. It has been a huge reduction in smog and in asthma cases among the old and the young. So the clean air rules have nothing to do with it. What does have something to do with the high energy prices is the fact that we've allowed all these recent mergers between ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, Conoco, and Phillips, and we have consolidated ownership over refineries so that only five companies now control more than half of the domestic refinery capacity, and the top 10 refiners control almost 80% of the U.S. refinery market. With that kind of control over refinery capacity, these companies can unilaterally manipulate gasoline supplies. That's exactly what the Federal Trade Commission concluded when they found that these companies have financial incentive and the ability to intentionally withhold gasoline from the marketplace in order to drive prices up. That is the number one reason, and that's why Public Citizen urges the listeners out there to contact your senators, Levin and Stabenow, and tell them to pass a law making it illegal for companies to withhold gasoline for the sole purpose of driving prices up. That is a very, very reasonable start to holding oil companies accountable and protecting consumers and encouraging competition.
Well, it also strikes me, you know, of course, so much more about all of this than I do, but I've never really taken with the argument about they have to incur, they being the oil refiners, have to incur greater costs. If they have greater costs in order not to poison the citizenry and the environment, why should we have to pay for it? It's their product. I mean, there ought to be some sense of a profitability of a company that only goes with a certain distance. In other words, if you're middle class like I am, I was going to say us. You work for a nonprofit.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether it includes you in that or not. But like me, if the gas goes up to $1.90, it's kind of I don't like it, but it doesn't do much to me. If you're making $17,000 a year and suddenly gas has gone up 60, 70 cents in a year and you're driving 40 miles a day in order to get jobs that are scattered all over the Detroit metropolitan area, that really hurts. So it is a sense these huge companies making these billion-dollar profits that are hurting the poor and the working poor the most.
Absolutely. The economy is not benefited when ExxonMobil and these other companies are posting record profits. I absolutely support we need companies to post profits. The profit motive is a wonderful thing, but there is a limit. You know, Enron reached that limit in California when it was price gouging consumers. And right now, ExxonMobil and the others are price gouging consumers. It's not fair, it's not right, and consumers are hurting, and the economy is hurting. I mean, when ExxonMobil posts after-tax profits of $21.5 billion in 2003 alone, something is wrong here. Clearly, if this was simply a case where OPEC was driving the higher costs and ExxonMobil was simply forced to pass on those higher costs to consumers, it wouldn't be recording record profits at every stage of production. The fact is ExxonMobil is breaking records, not only in its production, not only in its refining, but also in its retail distribution. That clearly is a sign that we have uncompetitive markets, that ExxonMobil has the power and the ability to unilaterally set prices. That's not competitive, that's not the American way, and it should be illegal.
Well, we haven't even really gotten many ways to the basis of all this, which is this is fossil fuel usage and what that portends. I mean, oil is really a disaster, every component of it, from pumping to transportation to refining to its eventual use in our cars. It's destructive to the environment, to people's health, it creates wars, on and on. It's hard to say that there's anything really good about it. But it's interesting that you said that the United States produces 37% of its own domestic oil consumption needs. Could we conserve enough to actually bring that down, I mean, significantly close to that? I mean, that's huge. I mean, knocking off two-thirds of energy consumption. But, I mean, I think of lots of ways. Could we really take a huge bite out of it just through conservation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're never going to become energy independent, okay? But we can raise our fuel economy standards. You know, they haven't been updated in 15 years. And as a result, the average fuel economy of today's fleet of cars and trucks is worse than it was 15 years ago. For a company, for a country that is the king of technology in the world, it is an outrage that we have the most inefficient cars of the entire world. Right now, as a result of our emphasis on gas-guzzling SUVs and small trucks, Europe and Japan have taken the lead in producing the most fuel-efficient, energy-efficient automobiles and other transportation. Does this sound familiar to you? This is exactly what the U.S. auto industry did in the 1970s. It grew complacent, it stopped innovating, and it stuck to very profitable, large gas guzzlers. And when the oil crisis hit, when the Arab oil embargo occurred in the 1970s, the U.S. auto industry was caught flat-footed. And the Japanese and European automakers quickly filled in the demand for leaner, more efficient automobiles. The U.S. auto industry is setting itself up again for failure because they've grown too complacent on the highly lucrative but gas-guzzling SUV market. And we have lost considerable market share to the Japanese and European automakers. And we're just going to learn this painful lesson again when gas prices keep going through the roof and consumers eventually are going to be forced to move on to something. Instead, what we should be doing here, Peter, is mandating improved fuel economy standards so that the domestic automakers can begin to compete again with their Japanese and European counterparts.
Unfortunately, we put most of this up to the Republicans. Neither party seems to have the political will, if not only to take on the oil companies and the refiners, but also to take on the citizenry that's in love with these big gas guzzlers. Not that I have a particularly, I don't have an SUV, but my car is a sedan. It's not a particularly good on mileage, but... do you agree with me that there's not the political will in Washington currently?
Oh, yeah. We have no leadership in Washington when it comes to tough decisions. A lot of that is because of the powerful influence that the oil industry has over Washington. You know, like I said, $67 million that the oil industry has contributed to finance the campaigns of federal candidates, with almost 80% of that going to Republicans. So that's a heavily partisan industry, and one of the reasons why Congress and the White House are failing to take the tough decisions. But, you know, your listeners out there can do a lot. You can get in touch with your senators, Carl Levin and Debbie Stabenow, and demand an immediate investigation into anti-competitive practices by ExxonMobil, Chevron Texaco, Marathon Oil, and the others, to pass a law immediately making it illegal for these companies to do what Enron did in California and what they're doing to gas prices today, which is intentionally withhold supplies from the market. That should be illegal. And we should adopt aggressive fuel economy standards. If we just improve our fuel economy standards from the current 27.5 miles per gallon to 40 miles a gallon over the next decade, we will save 54 billion gallons of oil. That will be about a third of our total consumption today. So that is a huge dent in our oil consumption if we were to increase the fuel economy and efficiency of our fleet of automobiles and trucks.
And this is something, gee, that just affects all of us. Right in the pocketbook, I want to thank you, as usual, Tyson Slocum, for being with us. Tyson is the Research Director for Public Citizens Energy Program, and you can go to citizen.org and find this report. It's called Mergers, Manipulation, and Mirages, How Oil Companies Keep Gasoline Prices High and Why the Energy Bill Doesn't Help. Good reading, and if we want to find out what's happening in the world, good place to start. Tyson Slocum, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Hey, thanks for checking out WRIF.com. While you're here, don't forget to join the Riff Viber Crew. It's your ticket to a totally unfair internet advantage for the Riff on-air giveaways. Plus, you can win stuff that we don't even give away on the air. Awesome internet exclusives from WRIF.com and much more.
Oh, that sounds great.
Make sure you sign up with the Riff Cyber Crew today. Just click over to the Cyber Crew page while you're listening.
Any questions?
And thanks again for listening.
It's a dream. It's a miracle.
It's great for women, too.
WRIF.com or Riff Rock is coming right up.
There's a number you can call that guarantees you the lowest mortgage rate, period. That number is 1-888-64-DAVID. That's 1-888-64-DAVID. It's the number to CompleteMortgageSearch.com. One call, that's all. Or one click, it's that quick. 1-888-64-DAVID. And CompleteMortgageSearch.com begins the search, your search. They do it all. They survey the reputable lenders and present you with the best of the best rates. You don't waste time. You don't lose money. One call, that's all. One click, it's that quick. 1-888-64-DAVID. No hassle. 1-888-64-DAVID. No fooling. CompleteMortgageSearch.com. They do the work. You get the money. 1-888-64-DAVID. One call, that's all.
Time is running out. Time is running out on the best deal ever, on your opportunity to make an investment that can change your life forever. Time is running out on your chance to register for Oakland Community College's spring 2004 semester. Register on the web at www.oaklandcc.edu or visit any of OCC's five convenient campuses to register for your choice of classes in literally hundreds of subjects. Classes like business, psychology, computer information systems, physics, English, pre-engineering, robotics, and more. If you're a four-year university student and want to get some classes out of the way before you go back in the fall, or if you just want to take a giant step to a better life, Oakland Community College is your educational answer.
Call or visit your local OCC campus now. They're in Auburn Hills, Waterford, Farmington Hills, Royal Oak, and Southfield. Oakland Community College at www.oaklandcc.edu. Get anywhere from here.
Classes begin May 10th.
The case of home loan applicant Matt Seitz, a young software salesman with nerves of steel.
Compatible? What? I have no idea. Would you just give me a sec to figure it out?
Make that nerves of tin.
Mister, please, fries or onion rings?
Too much pressure.
Make that nerves of dough. You see, lately, Matt was a mess. The tribulation of getting a home loan had frazzled his thinking ability. Then Matt went to Washington Mutual Home Loans. They soothed his concerns with several affordable loan options. Now Matt's back to his suave salesman self.
So, Sharon, what do you say we head back to my new domicile and check out the wine cellar? Ah! I'll take that as a maybe.
Congratulations, Matt. Homeowner, ladies' man, congratulations. Washington Mutual Home Loans. The power of yes, an equal housing lender.
Call 1-888-WAMU-LEND so you can get into the house without the hassles. That's the power of yes.
You're logged on at WRIF.com.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. And it's a pleasure to bring back to the Peter Werbe Show someone who's been with us on several occasions and who helps us think about how to get through the minefield of media and politics and ethics. And how do we, here, I'll grab his subtitle before I introduce him, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. How do we affirm ourselves as human beings when there are so many forces out there trying to manipulate us? My guest is Robert Jensen. He is a professor of media law, ethics, and politics at the University of Texas in Austin. And the last time we had him on, he had written the book Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream. That's among lots of other books he's done, and you've probably seen his byline in any number of other mainstream papers, USA Today, the LA Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, lots of others. The book is Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. Bob Jensen, welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Always great to be with you, Peter.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry, I was just looking over at my clock, Bob, make sure I'd pushed all the buttons I have indeed. People say, do you ever edit these? No, what the hell, we'll leave this in, right? Okay, it's published by City Lights Publisher, citylights.com. This is the old Ferlinghetti, famous City Lights bookstore that published Allen Ginsberg and a lot of the other beat poets. So how did you hook up with City Lights?
Well, I was lucky to have a contact with one of the editors, and I was really excited to publish because, as you point out, they have a really important place in the history of publishing in the U.S. as a place where work that couldn't get into the mainstream could get in. And they're mainly known as a fiction and poetry publisher, but they do a small number of nonfiction political books. And I just found their editors really understood what I was trying to do in this book, which was to talk about politics in a way that retained a kind of critical spirit and retained progressive values, but could speak to a general audience that could get out and spark debate among ordinary people.
Well, and that's pretty hard because there's little debate in this country. Most everything flows from the corporate and the conservative media downwards, and what passes as the left wing usually are centrists, as we've seen in all these studies, like from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And that, I think, goes to both parts of your title of your book, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. I don't know if that was really a question, but...
Let me just talk a bit about the title, because both things are important to me. One is the recognition that we are, in fact, citizens of the empire, that even on the right, even in very conservative circles now, people are openly using the term empire. Of course, the difference is on the right, they're rather celebratory about it. They're happy that we're an empire, and those of us in the progressive world are critical of it. But the point of the title is that we are full citizens. You know, we're not subjects of the British Empire. We're not under the thumb of a totalitarian empire. And as citizens of the empire, we have, I think, added responsibilities, moral responsibilities to involve ourselves in politics in important ways. And, of course, the subtitle, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, suggests that the only way we can, if we live in an empire, if we live in the most affluent society that's ever existed in the history of the planet, the society with the most destructive military capacity that's ever existed and a demonstrated willingness to use that often in ways that target civilians. If we live in that kind of world, the only way we're going to claim our humanity is to struggle, and it's political struggle. So the book's title really, for me, sums up the importance of becoming involved in political movements that can try and bring humanity and, in a sense, sanity to U.S. foreign policy especially.
Well, Robert Jensen, we've been making analogies with the Roman Empire for about the last 300 years to assess particular governments, and you mentioned the U.S. now as an empire. Rome went through a period where it was a republic and then became an empire. The republic is, that phase is gone?
Well, you know, democracy, whether it's, you know, in a republic or some other form, is always a struggle. One never has achieved democracy. Democracy is always something one is moving toward. And the problem is, however close we might have gotten to it in the past, we seem to be moving away. There's an old quote, I think, from Mark Twain, that you can't have an empire abroad and a democracy at home. The two are inconsistent. That is, what it takes to maintain an empire, the kind of militarism and secrecy and concentration of power that is required for empire building, simply is inconsistent with democracy. Now, the problem is, I think, and you alluded to this in your in an earlier question, is in a world in which we're all kind of fat and happy, in a sense, and which politics has become a kind of mediated spectacle, it's easy to believe that we still have a vibrant democracy, because, after all, we vote every couple of years, and we see political discussion all around us on TV. But is that, in fact, a healthy democracy? Is that a democracy in a deep and rich and meaningful sense? That's the question I think we have to confront. I think far too many people, at least as I look around my circles, that's both professionally in the academy, as well as friends and family, I see too many people who have simply opted out of any meaningful involvement in political life beyond perhaps voting every now and then. That's, mm-hmm. I think, the struggle that we all have to engage in.
Well, today, as we're recording this interview, there is a major uprising against the U.S. occupation in Iraq, and all of it, the cost in human lives of American soldiers, Iraqi civilians, even the Iraqi insurgents, is just so fraught with you know, the poignancy of the loss of life, bringing to light, in my mind, the mistakes of the Bush administration. And I mention it to other people, and mostly people, they say, it's funny, about three-quarters of them said, wow. Yeah, and then went on with our daily business.
Right.
I guess when we live in a society where people are so divorced from the levers of power, and really all we are spectators, what Guy Debord called the society of the spectacle, in many ways it's hard to expect more from people.
Well, of course, that is the challenge. People have, this didn't happen overnight. Over a long period of time, people have been encouraged to disconnect from politics. And politics, in some sense, you know, the way in which we often critique politics as being the realm of sleazy, self-interested, power-hungry people, in some ways that's an honest reflection of the world, but it also, I think, consistently has given people the impression that there's no way to be involved in politics except as a sleazy, self-interested, unpleasant person. But, of course, part of what we're talking about here is just opening up the definition of politics. Politics is more than what the Republican and the Democratic parties do. It's more than just electoral politics. It's more than just scrambling for votes at election time. It's about the way in which daily discourse goes on. You made the point that sometimes people are simply not aware of what's happening. How do you get to the point where people talk about politics in their day-to-day life, not just what was on TV last night? This is a real struggle, and as someone teaching in a university, I see it particularly, and it's particularly painful to see it in young people, because, after all, when we're young, it's supposed to be the time we're most engaged, most critical, most willing to upset the apple cart in some ways. But even young people have been conditioned to essentially believe that politics is for somebody else, not for them, and that's the crucial task. You know, locally here in Austin, I work with a group that's trying to do that, trying to create spaces where people can come together, talk about politics, hear speakers, get an education that is far more expansive than the education we get in formal institutions.
My guest is Robert Jensen on the Peter Werby Show. The book is Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. It's published by City Lights Publishers in San Francisco. CityLights.com is the website. I'll have this all on my website, PeterWerby.com, as well. It is daunting, I mean, because people feel that you can see it from the voting turnouts, is that we talk about these incredibly important elections, say in 2000, and barely half the people even bothered to vote. And now with this intense debate about the direction of our country and who's going to be in charge of it, I mean, I would be very surprised if the voter turnout even hit 60%.
Well, you're hitting at one particular manifestation of a depoliticized society, which is people, I mean, we all know that we live in a democracy and we can vote, but increasingly people don't vote. Now, one interpretation of that is they're lazy or they're stupid or they're whatever. Another interpretation is that they realize that voting often doesn't make much difference. The old argument that the Republicans and Democrats are just different versions of the same pro-business party is increasingly true, although in this election people are seeing that the Bush administration, while not, you know, some radical departure from previous administrations, is a sort of ideologically fanatical band of thugs that really has taken the U.S. in a direction that is so radically right-wing that even, you know, centrists in the Democratic Party find it rather alarming. So we do have a choice, and one would hope that that choice would be reflected in greater participation in voting, but I would also hope it would be reflected in a more vibrant and vigorous public discussion. Again, if that's going to happen, it's not going to happen because the mainstream corporate media is going to encourage it. It's going to happen because ordinary people get together and start a neighborhood group or start a book club or start a political local grassroots organization. That's where politics is done, not just in the voting booth.
Well, I agree, and actually I appreciate that reminder, because generally I've said that voting ought to be, in terms of your political life, about the 27th thing you do down the list after you have energized your committee, community to look at local issues, to have a book club or a study group about national and international issues, of organizing a demonstration which manifests the feeling of people in your community, that kind of thing. And taking part in your union, taking part in the Human Rights Committee of your church, stuff like that. And then, oh, yeah, I got to go out and vote for the lesser of the two evils, don't I? Yeah, I should do that. It is a Tuesday, the first Tuesday in November. So,
And you make a really, if I can butt in a bit, sure. You make a really important point about churches and unions. You know, unions are on the downslide in this country, unfortunately, and I think we need to all think about how to revigorate unions, and not just in terms of our own self-interest in terms of wages and working conditions, but also to make unions a place where political discussion goes on. And, of course, churches are one of the other places. I personally am a fairly secular person, but I end up talking in churches, doing lectures and discussions in churches all the time, because that's one place where people come together to talk about values, talk about what matters. And I think we have to look at all of those spaces that some of us may not think of as political, but we should really put on the political map in that sense.
Well, let me just give you two real quick anecdotes. One, I was listening to what I can only tolerate, about 5 minutes a day or 5 minutes three times a week of Rush Limbaugh, and he was saying that he is exercising his God-given gift to talk, and you, the audience, are your God-given gift to listen. In other words, he was asking this audience to be passive. Then I was thinking, too, after this terrible bombing in Madrid in March, how after that, if millions of people, what did they think, maybe even a full 25% of the entire population came out in solidarity and in grief and in rage. And here in the United States, when we suffered our greatest catastrophe, we essentially all just watched television. And that, again, shows this advanced passivity, this feeling that we do not have the capacity to be the subject of history, that, in other words, the actors in history, but only remain the object of history, to be moved by big, powerful forces or invisible forces or dangerous forces. And that, I think, really reinforces an almost kind of a Mobius strip of passivity.
I agree. And of course, we should always remember that people in power like it that way.
Sure.
They want us to stay passive because then they can play in their own arenas without the inconvenience of having people butting in. Now, you mentioned Europe. One of the things that's really interesting about this job I have is I end up talking to a large number of foreign journalists and academics who come through the U.S. on often on State Department-funded tours. The State Department pays to bring them over here so they can see the glories of American democracy. And there are two things that these foreign folks almost unanimously observe when they come to the U.S. One is how far the American political spectrum is pushed to the right. And I think people here don't often understand that in not only in Europe, but all over the world, literally, there's a far broader range of political ideas that are in the mainstream. There are socialist ideas that you will see represented in mainstream media in other parts of the world. That's almost never the case here. The other thing they say is not just that politics in the U.S. has been pushed to the right, but that the entire society is so depoliticized. Even when people come to the university, they're struck by how just completely politically inert. And these people say to me, where do people go to talk politics? And the answer I give them, of course, is that for a large number of people, that simply doesn't happen. I was talking to a student today after class, and I said, what are people in your social circles, are they talking about Iraq? You know, the Iraqi resistance to the occupation is growing. There's now what looks like it will be a two-front resistance, not only the Sunni in the center, but the Shia in the south. You know, this is a major development that could affect all of us in important ways. And she said, well, you know, to the degree anybody has an opinion, they mainly want to just yell at each other. So most people just stay quiet. And she said it's hard to get a conversation going about what is undoubtedly one of the most important events happening in our lives right now. That's the state of the world. How do we get over that? Well, that's the long process of political organizing. And in a sense, simply people not being afraid to talk to other people. This is what I'm always sort of amazed at. When I say, you know, do you talk to your coworkers? Do you talk to family? People often say, well, it causes such arguments.
Sure.
But, you know, arguing, I think we have to rethink arguing. Personally, I find arguing one of the most enjoyable activities I do. By arguing, I don't mean, you know, shouting at people. I mean trying to put forward an argument, you know, have some evidence, have some logic behind it, trying to persuade people of a point of view. That can be done in a way that's very healthy, very creative, and, you know, at least in my own experience, just plain fun. And that's what I think we have to get back to.
Well, Bob Jensen, obviously politics can often be acrimonious, sometimes even solved, as we see so frequently, at the barrel of a gun. Even inside of countries, we've had our civil war. Yet, it seems to me that over the last 20 years or so, the well of political discourse has really been poisoned by the right. I was listening. It sounds like I listen all the time, but I was listening like for about 3 minutes of Rush, and he was virtually saying that anyone to the left of Mussolini or to the left of him were traitors and wanted us to lose and wanted us to be weak and were unwilling to be forceful against people that meant us great harm. And you have the Ann Coulters of the world and people like that had this fascistic, and I use that word advisedly because it's call your enemies names, but fascist in the sense of wanting to destroy totally your enemies. I mean, people on the right talking about having a liberal museum where you'd put the last liberal on display and what have you. So and the use, in fact, you talk about it in your book, Citizens of the Empire, things like support the troops, and that if you don't support the troops on the terms that are set by the empire and its chieftain or chieftains, then you are traitorous. You are an enemy of the country. So there is, in fact, you have this chapter heading called Cutting Through the Fog of Political Rhetoric. The fog of political rhetoric has been set by the far right, which represents, what, maybe 20% of the country, but yet they've been so damn successful.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of discussion around this so-called liberal network that Al Franken and others are involved in. And one of the assessments it made is liberal politics doesn't work on talk radio, because talk radio is all about being aggressive and giving no quarter and not being interested in nuanced debate, but being interested in trouncing your opponent. And the point was that's what sells on talk radio. But people on the liberal and left side aren't so good at that. And in a way, I think that's an accurate assessment. When I'm involved in political debate, I want to actually hear what other people have to say so I can respond to it, counter it. That's not the game that the right wing plays. I think you're absolutely right. Now, in all fairness, increasingly, the Democratic Party, all of the people involved in mainstream politics, are using the same tools of manipulation, the use of large amounts of money to essentially buy elections through advertising and PR. That's going on all sides. But I think you're right. There is a particularly, I don't want to use the word hateful necessarily, but aggressive and ugly undertone to a lot of that. I mean, Ann Coulter is sort of the poster child of this, someone who has no concern for basic intellectual honesty and, in a sense, no respect for other people. And in that atmosphere, it's hard to engage because you either play that game or, in a sense, you lose almost by definition. So these are, you know, difficult questions about how to respond politically, which is, again, why, for me, in talk radio is the place to intervene, and the fact there are shows like yours is incredibly important. But there's also that local level, that personal level of engagement with friends, coworkers, families, church members. You know, that's another place where politics happens. Yes, mass media matters, but we shouldn't forget about those other sites as well.
Well, let me give the audience an example of how this all works. A friend of mine said, and one of the reasons I'm hesitating. I don't know if I want to call myself liberal. I always say I'm much more radical than that. In fact, when people used to call me up and say, "You sound like a communist," I say, "Really? I'm much more radical than that." But anyway, this friend of mine said, it takes a second to tie a knot and an hour to untie it. So someone here, I'm going to say this to you. Bob Jensen, who are you going to defend, our country or those terrorists? There you go. That's exciting. It's emotive. It's filled with drama. And, it's obviously have you stopped beating your wife yet? Question. But that's it. So I'm going to ask you that. Bob Jensen, who are you going to support, our country or those terrorists?
Well, I'm not married, so I don't have a wife to beat. of course, you're absolutely right, because the response to that is I support not the terrorists nor the people who want to make war using the excuse of terrorism. I support the people all over the world who are engaged in the struggle to create democracy through nonviolent change. Now, if I want to get on their side, and if I want to get my own country on their side, then we can start talking about the possibility of a just world, a possibility of moving toward real democracy in places that now do not know democracy. In other words, if you want to undermine terrorism, which I think we all do, I'm, as much as anyone, not interested in having a plane flown into my office building right now. I want to do that by creating the conditions in which terrorists, people who want to use those methods, will not find support. That's the goal. And if that, you know, in the political discourse, if there are places where that's going to be too nuanced, too long of an answer, well, then I'll go to places where people do want to have those kinds of conversations.
Well, you know, in many ways, the last sentence you said is even though every bit of it was well spoken, that is it. If you have to exist in a forum, and sometimes you hear these right-wing shows, and you, if you started saying that, one of these right-wing freaks would start saying, "Come on, Jensen, who are you going to support? Our country or those damn terrorists?" And you'd say, "Could I finish, please, my thought?" And then you'd start saying, "Where the hell was I in my thought? I've been on these damn programs with the, you know, like on CNN and Fox and all that." And a discourse, I mean, worthy of his name, is not taking place there. It is just a freak show. And I even stopped accepting offers from it. I mean, people said, you are offered to go on CNN and you didn't go. But I was just like, you know, the left-wing leper with a bell around my neck, you know, for part of the entertainment. So I gave it up.
Yeah, I think that those are strategic decisions. I still go on almost every media show, whether it's radio or television, where I'm invited, knowing full well exactly what you said, and I think your decision is perfectly legitimate as well. You're in a sense being set up. You're being used as fodder for jokes and to prove that anybody on the left is really crazy. But you know, those shows. I've been on the Bill O'Reilly show 3 times, and if Bill O'Reilly's producers called me today, I'd go on again. Not because I think there's going to be a much of a meaningful discussion, but I have had the experience of being able to make a point. You know, in a 6-minute slot, you might get the chance to make one point and one point only, but that's one point that otherwise would not be made on that show. So, I don't know. Maybe I'm a masochist. Maybe I just like being beaten up.
No, I do respect that, and it's tough. I mean, for instance, Sean Hannity, if you ever listen to him, when he has liberal guests every once in a while, he had, I can't even think of it, somebody from the Clinton administration, and it occurred to me, working in radio, his level was maybe 25-30% higher than his guest. And as he would ask the guest a question, and as the guest was speaking, Hannity's saying, can you believe this guy? You know, talking right over him, and the guest was unaware that he was being ridiculed as he was trying to give a forthright answer, whether, you know, Hannity or the audience or anybody agreed with it. You know, Bob Jensen, this is crazy. We just have flown through our 25 minutes and barely even scratched the surface of Citizens of the Empire. To me, the very, very powerful subtitle, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, extraordinarily important challenge in this world. Maybe we could just go out by quoting from the back Norman Solomon, who's been a guest on this show any number of times, endorses the book by saying it will jolt readers into a truer reckoning with their own beliefs and capabilities. Citizens of the Empire is a book of realism and hope, a strong antidote to the poisons of conformity and despair. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. And the book, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, City Lights Publishers, it's available from citylights.com. Bob Jensen, thanks so much for being with me on The Peter Werby Show.
Oh, it was a great, great time. Thanks as always, Peter.
Night Call is a public affairs presentation of 101 WRIF Detroit. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management or sponsors of WRIF Radio. Night Call is hosted every Sunday night by Peter Werby and produced by OD. Stay tuned for more Riff Rock coming right up on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Man, how do you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want, and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control, and see how much longer you last with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
Okay, so now my friend Barry wants to buy a motorcycle, a really big motorcycle, but he's a working guy, trying like me to pinch his pennies. Then all our friends told Barry, buy a bike in Motown, buy a bike in Motown. So Barry, who stays home nights pinching his pennies, thinks he can get the better deal if he shucks the competition. Those other dealers showed him what he could get with his pennies. And then his head explodes. Then I take my friend Barry to Motown, Harley Davidson, and Taylor. They tell him, big used police bike, save today. And he says, no way. And they say, save today. And he says, no way. And they say, save today. And Larry says, okay. And now we are riding our Harleys, and Barry has his macho, macho motorcycle and didn't have to part with all his pennies. The end.
For sale, specials, events, or just to look at cool pictures, log on to MotownHarley.com. Motown Harley Davidson in Taylor on Telegraph, just north of Eureka.
Remember, guys, chicks stick a guy on the real motorcycle. Buy a bike at Motown! Okay.
Opportunity doesn't sleep. Hi, I'm David Hall reporting late night for Rock Financial. You've heard about Rock Financial's exclusive smart arm, and you want more information right now? Well, we can help at rockfinancial.com. Visit rockfinancial.com late night to find out more about the smart arm. Get an interest rate fixed in for 3 years under 3%. You can even apply online, and a mortgage expert will call you back the next day. RockFinancial.com's mortgage calculators can help you understand just how low your monthly payment can be with our exclusive new smart arm. Increase your cash flow, pay down debt, whatever you want. It's all possible when you're working with a mortgage expert. Get a head start on tomorrow. Visit RockFinancial.com right now. We're Michigan's largest mortgage company, available anytime, anywhere, evenings, weekends, and late night online. Visit RockFinancial.com to get started late night. Right now, go to RockFinancial.com.
Rate subject to market conditions. APR is 3.6%. Points due at closing. Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company and equal housing lender. Details at RockFinancial.com.
You've waited long enough, sitting at your desk planning your approach. You know things would be so hot, so fast, so rock and roll, so much better than it is now. You just need that one thing and your life would be complete. You know you're not happy. Stop sitting there and make your move. Spence Howard School of Broadcast Arts is exactly the next move you need to make to turn those dreams into reality. Hi, this is Freeman Scott Randall from The Rip, and I've got the greatest job in the world because I give Specs a call. Before radio, I was right where you are now. Fast food, telemarketing, data entry. All I needed was a little courage to make the move that would change my life for good. And the spring fling is all you can handle now. No worries, my friend. Call Specs Howard at 248-358-9000 by April 30th to set up a date. Take a tour of the school and check things out. There's zero commitment. Specs doesn't need to send you flowers or candy in the morning. This is your life. Do you really want to spend another unfulfilling year handing out tacos, sweeping the floor, and for kidding some dude a cup of coffee? No! Don't wait. Spring classes are forming now. And of course, morning, afternoon, and evening options are available. Call 248-358-9000 today. That's 248-358-9000 for the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts in Southfield. This is where you start. It's where I started.
Grab the iPod. Get the tunes.
Maybe score that prize back.
Including a 50-inch plasma TV. Get wired with the Riff.
Listen for details.
From 111-101 WRIF Detroit.
Riff rocks.
Please allow me to adjust my pants so that I may dance the good time dance and put the onlookers and innocent bystanders into a trance. Blood for elected officials, the beast you see got 50 eyes. Bring it on home, spread the wealth, play it cool, the hands been dealt. Now all the odds are in our favor, save the victory speeches for later. Streets on fire, the mob goes wild, wild, wild. Streets on fire, the mob goes wild. 21 guns, blacksmith. Nice, but Afro for Aroni. That man on the TV who speaks to the day, you know that man's a phony. Everybody move to Canada, smoke lots of pot. Everybody move to Canada right now. Here's how we do it. Bum rush the border guard before he and his dog ever knew.